welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff. This week on the show, kind of a loose, fun week. I'm going to review what I've played so far of Fire Emblem Warriors for the Nintendo Switch. Sean, you're going to talk about kind of belatedly Neo for the PS4. Which you've been wanting to talk about for a while, and you finally got a chance to play.
Absolutely. I think looking at sort of like the I've kind of looked around to sort of figure out how deep I am into the game. I think I'm about halfway through. And nice. And to give you a preview on how I feel about the game, I already bought the DLC.
So. Oh, good. Nice. And I'm about I'm over halfway through Fire Emblem Warriors as well. So these will be... We have not finished the games, but we have enough to talk about them.
Yeah, there's a whole lot to talk about with Neo. It's
exciting.
A really good fucking game.
Nice. I'm excited to hear about that. And then we are also going to do some news, including the news that EA has shut down Visceral Studios, which I think is... one of the bigger pieces of video game news of the year.
Oh, so, absolutely, yeah.
We will have to talk about a lot about that. But first, Sean, a couple of notes of housekeeping.
Yep.
As we talked about last week, we've put the Patreon on hold for now, but we are continuing with our monthly classic Doctor Who pods.
Yep.
And I think it's one of our favorite things we've done on the podcast in years. It's just so much fun. And we are going to keep doing it. And later this week, I think I'm going to have it come out on Wednesday, will be the third Doctor one, where we talk about the story The Daemons. Which, if you have not watched it, you owe it to yourself to see that bit of craziness.
Yeah, to pull back the curtain a bit, Jonathan and I literally just recorded the episode talking about that, and so I feel a bit high off of that conversation.
It was
a really fucking good story.
It's so fun, and you know, next month we'll get into the fourth Doctor, so we are full steam ahead on that. And again, if you've never watched Classic Doctor Who, but you enjoy hearing us talk about the new show and all that, I think this is a great way to kind of have a curated guide through the best moments of Doctor Who history.
Yeah.
Because Sean knows all about it.
I do, yes. We talked a lot about Barry Letts, and he's a fun guy to talk about.
Yep, so very excited about that. That is very fun. I don't have a lot of stuff to get into, because that's kind of Fire Emblem Warriors, and we'll get into that. The one piece of stuff I do have is Doctor Who related. Y'all know I've been watching the third Doctor run. That's so much fun. I talk about it more on the bonus pod, so you can listen to it there. I am also continuing my watch through of the Moffat run, which I've been updating you guys on, because I'm going to do a ranking when we get to our special Moffat retrospective of every Moffat episode.
I'm very excited to see absurd ranking. It's one of my favorite, like, mini episode, like, topic things we do on this podcast is you make a list of which I am in no way privy to.
And but it's always an absurd list.
Yes, it's always an absurd list, and then I have to find some way to grapple with this ranking you've done live on air.
I think, in general, you'll agree with my rankings, because I think we're at a point where I think you and I generally agree about the peaks and valleys of the Moffat run, but, like, I'm in Matt Smith's last season, which is to say I'm in season 7B, or season 7B part 2, whatever, how we count the snowmen, I don't know. The snowmen in Bells of St. John are better than you remember. And I have
always carried a torch for the snowman. I think that is a great story. That
it
has
is.
A bit of a letdown of, like, not the best ending to his plot ever, but
no,
it's a really good Christmas special.
The snowman is, like, the highest on the list before I get into the point of, like, stories I really love. Like, it's the last one right before, I'll just give you a hint, the Doctor dances. So right under that.
Okay.
But, like, you know, there's a lot of, I am getting to a point, though, where there is enough titles on that list is getting actively hard to rank them.
Yeah, I feel like something like probably, like, off the top of my head, something like Bells of St. John would be the hardest one to, like, where do you put that one? Like,
it's really hard. I'll tell you, I was grappling with where it goes in relation to, for instance, A Good Man Goes to War.
Right, yes.
And that's a tough one, because I think A Good Man Goes to War has higher highs in it. I also think it's more encumbered by a larger story arc I really don't like.
Yeah.
So it's like...
But, like, the sort of middle-of-the-road Moffat episodes, I feel, would be very difficult to rank.
Some of them are. But anyway, it's been fun, though. Some of my thoughts have, like, I've been really surprised by things. Like, I always liked The Snowman. I loved it this time. You know, I never loved Wedding of River Song, but I didn't know if I hated it. That is a epically terrible episode of television. It's easily bottom of the list at this moment.
Uh-huh.
There's just things like that. Like, it's like... And it, like, to the point where I then also moved down Impossible Astronaut, like, 5 spaces. Because it's like, I just can't, it's too tied to a terrible story for me to have any real affection for it.
I can get that. I feel like because the last time I watched Impossible Astronaut, I felt like I was able to cloister myself enough from that to enjoy that story.
Yeah, but the second part of that story is also really boring.
Yeah, Day of the Moon,
Anyway. But, like, it's been fun and interesting. The funnest thing for me is being now in the Clara era, where, like...
Yes, yeah.
Jenna Coleman is great. She was always great. She is not yet playing the character we know and love from the Capaldi years. And yet, every, you know, few scenes, like, Moffat will hit on something in the writing that Coleman latches onto and plays the Clara we will come to know and love, like the Clara who just takes no shit from the Doctor, sees him as an equal, and has a very different kind of power dynamic with him. And then the camera will cut to Matt Smith, and I'm like, right, he's the Doctor still. Uh-huh. Because I just, she goes, and that's nothing against Matt Smith. It's just that she is defined by Peter Capaldi, not by Matt Smith.
Yeah.
You know, like if you had Amy on screen with Capaldi, it'd be weird, you know? Like, yeah, that's not his companion. So there's just things like that, but it's fun. I'm watching through these on my Blu-rays, and the next disc, you know, I just put in the Blu-ray player to continue, has two Mark Gatiss episodes on
yep,
it.
Yep, yeah.
So that is a...
Season 7 is such a just insane season of Doctor Who. Like,
it is. I mean, because that's the thing that...
So weird to go back to.
That disc has two Mark Gatiss episodes. It also has The Rings of Akutan and Hyde, which are fantastic.
Yeah.
So, like, up and down.
Yes. It's just, you know, because that's also... Matt Smith has a whole new costume that I think is amazing. Like, I really love Matt Smith in Season 7B and, like, to Day of the Doctor and Time of the Doctor. I think, like, where he takes his version of the Doctor is really interesting to me.
And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about is, like, in these little discussions as we go through, I don't want to spoil everything we have to say about Moffat, but we're probably not going to get into, like, Matt Smith as an actor as much because that's not the focus.
Yeah.
And we've talked about him a lot. But, like, I remember, because we reviewed in... I reviewed in some form or another every Matt Smith episode, and I've reviewed in some form or another every Capaldi episode, so I know these pretty intimately. And I remember saying several times over the Smith run that I thought he got better with each year. Like, he just got more confident and mature a performer. And that's not putting down his early work. It's just he gets better at it. And that's praise. And I was right. Like, when I rewatched this, like, he does. Like, I think the storytelling gets rockier. He is such a fascinating actor to me. And I want to see the second phase of his career, which has started with things like The Crown. But, like, you
and
know,
Terminator Genisys, you know, all the great hits.
Because I think he's a pretty phenomenal actor,
absolutely,
especially by the end of his run. And you're right, in Season 7B, like, the Clara story is a weird, rocky one. The way he plays that is beautiful. Yeah. And I think he, again, and this was always true of Matt Smith, he finds a maturity and grace beyond his age.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing. And just as, like, David Tennant is well into a second act of his career where, like, you would be forgiven for Doctor Who not being the first thing you mention with David Tennant,
sure,
which
yeah.
is amazing. He's completely escaped typecasting. I think Matt Smith could do that, too. He
yeah.
really has it in him. And I, The Crown, he's really good in that, and I want to see what else he's going to go on to do. But yeah, same with like some of the companions in this run, too, like Jenna Coleman and Karen Gillan is now a full-on movie star.
Yeah.
It's cool. They've produced a lot of hit actors in Modern Who.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But anyway, it's a fun project, and I can almost taste the Capaldi years. They're so close. And
you got that unbelievable scene in The Snowman where they introduced the new TARDIS console room, which is basically the TARDIS. Like, they you know, put some new stuff into this stuff for the
Capaldi
version, but it's, like, the basic version with, like, the great lighting and stuff.
Oh, so
but
good.
They have, like, this really, like, for, like, fairy tale esque bright blue lighting in there for Matt Smith. That's just, like, it's such a beautiful set. It's such
a
great scene.
It is. I remember, so I'm watching this with my brother, and I would say, like, he'd say, oh, man, I love Matt Smith's TARDIS. And I'd be like, no, it's a really good TARDIS. The Capaldi one, though, and what he gets in 7B. And Thomas would be like, it was a little resistant to that. And then, like, we finished The Snowman. He's like, yeah, that TARDIS is better.
So good.
And again, nothing... I like his orange TARDIS, but the blue... My favorite thing is the main TARDIS console itself, which is the thing that stays unchanged between Smith and Capaldi. It's got those things on the top, those rotating,
yeah,
like...
spin.
With all the Gallifreyan characters... Oh, man. Those, like, if Chris Chibnall redesigns the TARDIS for Jodie Whittaker, fine. Just keep those.
Yeah.
Every Doctor should get those.
I mean, it's just, it's something I feel like we talk about with that set all the time. It's just, like, they have, there's so much stuff in that set that makes it so good for filming. And those spinny things, like, there's so many great shots in that show that make such great use of the weird spinny thing on the ceiling of either having the camera spin along with it and stuff like that. It's very good.
Yeah. I was also surprised. I like Season 7A more than I remembered.
Huh.
Which is the five final Amy and Rory ones. Amy and Rory, as characters, are very tired at that point.
Yeah.
Although I think Chris Chibnall does really fun stuff with them in The Power of Three up to the final line. But if you ignore the terrible final line, that's a pretty good episode. And, you know, so, and I think Angels Take Manhattan is up and down for me. But, like, I love Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Sure,
of Three is 90% great. Asylum of the Daleks is, I forgot, that's the only Moffat-written Dalek story up to that point. And then you do get one more with the two-parter with Capaldi. But that's a fun one because that's the first time he'd done a Dalek story. And it is, he feels energized by that. I even liked A Town Called Mercy this time.
Sure,
I remember that being an epically boring episode. I think it's built on an interesting thematic foundation. And it is one of the best shot episodes of Doctor Who of all time.
Sure, yeah.
In like that, because they shot it in Spain, but it looks so much like America. They did a very good job with the mise-en-scene of that episode.
Like for me, like Series 7A is such a weird beast because it just feels so aimless to me. And in a way that like it feels like it's like the unseen 11th Doctor adventures. That has like, there are definitely like story beats with Amy and Rory that do carry across there. But it's also like, it's such a like it was such an unneeded bit of like the maxi storytelling taking place there that they should have phased out Amy Drury by that point, that like even when those stories are good, I kind of forget that they happen. Like I feels like they just like are part of like this weird Doctor Who side thing that happened that doesn't ever really occur to me. Whereas like Season 7B, even though I think like it probably has like on average like worse episodes, like it has the two Mark Gatiss episodes, it has Name of the Doctor, which is not very good, but it felt like one, I felt like Matt Smith being able to like move on from Amy and Rory and get this new console room and costume and all this stuff and change his performance for the Doctor, like kind of gave it new life to me. And it feels like, especially once you, like, looking, when I rewatched it after Day of the Doctor and Time of the Doctor came out and could watch all those together, it felt like Series 7B, even if it's not the most brilliant direction in the world, had a maxi-level direction it was heading in. That makes it more memorable to me.
It has a push, and especially watching this time, knowing that the push led to two really good last Smith stories.
Yeah.
Is like, and one great one in Day of the Doctor.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and then would give way to the greatness of Master Capaldi.
Yeah, there's almost like some quality to it as well that feels like, you know, I don't think this is at all what they were trying to do at the time, but the way that like Clara is not allowed to be her own character feels like retroactively it's like a thematic element to like Matt Smith's performance as the Doctor. Is like he's kind of lost that touch with humanity.
I'll give you a preview of an essay I have like outline written for the Moffat era that I might finish, I might not, but I will present the whole thesis on the podcast when we do this, which is that the greatest mistake of the last two seasons for the 11th Doctor is that I think Stephen Moffat is afraid of consequences, and that becomes a thing with the Doctor. And the 12th Doctor's run is so much about consequences that a season culminates with him punching through a diamond wall because he is sad.
Yeah.
Like, it could not be more stark. And part of that is that one Doctor does not see people as people, and one Doctor sees people as people so much he like dies a little inside.
Yeah, and it's just that thing of, that again, like I do not think at all that was the intention while making Season 7, but it does, and there are a couple of other eras of Doctor Who where this is very much true of that, like once things have changed in a certain way, the way it has changed reflects even better on what came before, even if you didn't like it in the moment. It sort of creates this thematic contrast that is really dramatically compelling to me.
All right, we got to move on. But we love talking about Doctor Who, if you can't tell.
It's one of the main reasons why this podcast exists, honestly.
It is. And, you know, there's no new Doctor Who right now, so we got to find ways to do it.
Yeah.
It's.
I mean, also, again, we literally just talked about adult Doctor Who episode for 90 minutes. So I'm still high off of that. You get me going, I'll never stop.
Yes. All right. But let's get moving, Sean.
All right.
Let's talk about the news.
What's going on?
Three pieces of news. First off, stupid piece of news.
yeah.
They announced the title for the standalone Han Solo Star Wars movie.
Oh, yeah, we've been waiting for that for such a long time. It felt like they've just like been holding this back from us for some reason. What is it, Jonathan?
Well, they somehow found the worst, blandest, dumbest title they could. It's honestly pretty impressive. The title of this movie is Solo, a Star Wars story.
Huh.
Solo. I'd like a ticket for Solo, please. Man, yeah. Did you see Solo? Solo gets 3 stars.
I mean, man, like, the bar for what you needed to do to make, like, a half-decent title for this movie was so low, and yet they still didn't clear it.
I mean, I was, like, 99% sure it was just going to be Han Solo, a Star Wars story.
Yeah.
But I was still pulling for a creative one, like, going solo, flying solo, something like that.
Look, Ma, no hands. Like, Han Solo, hands.
Or I did a Twitter poll on this. I think one of the best titles could have just been Han Mibuki, a Star Wars story.
Yeah. I mean, it's something where if they were just going to go for the most just like nothing title for this movie, they should have gone with my idea of just call it Young Han Solo, a Star Wars story, and make it about his rap career on like Coruscant or something before he became a smuggler.
No, I don't. look, the title doesn't really matter. It can be a good or bad movie without it. But I'll say this. They fired the comedy directors because they were making too interesting a movie and got Ron Howard, who has made interesting movies, but I don't think was asked to do that here, and then gave it the blandest title they could. It just feels like this movie is going to be like half cold soup. I don't know.
I mean, it's just, it's the kind of thing that I don't think either of us would have, like, even really noticed if they had just announced this title, like, a year or 2 years ago.
Sure.
Like, when they were talking about, like, we're making this Han Solo, new Han Solo project. It's called Solo, a Star Wars Story. It's like, okay, yeah, that's whatever. Like, it's not the most amazing title in the world, but it's like, that's a perfectly descriptive title of this movie. But it's like, the specific way that it rolled out in that one, you have all, like, the drama of having the old directors, Lord Miller, fired and having Ron Howard come on. But there was, like, specifically how it was revealed was, like, in a Twitter video with Ron Howard, where he's, like, talking about, like, finally we can talk about this movie. Oh, hey, can we tell him what the title is? And then someone, like, hand off screen hands him a placard, and then he, like, turns the placard over and it says, Solo, a Star Wars Story, as if you're supposed to be fucking amazed by this title. Like, if this was something that was just released in a press release on, like, May the 4th,
right,
nobody would give a shit. But it's like, you make this big dramatic reveal about it with Ron Howard. It's like, dude, who gives a fuck?
It's just, it's the kind of thing where clearly they've probably known what this is for months. And, like, deciding to turn the title of your movie into a reveal is one of the dumber things I can imagine in marketing. Yeah. Your movie has a title or it doesn't. Uh-huh. And you can change the title much as you want later on, but just give it a fucking title.
Yeah.
Like, they probably were not shooting this as Untitled Han Solo Movie. On set, they had to have a title for it.
Yeah.
You know, like, just for the fucking, like, you know, snappers. It's just, it's crazy. Yeah. Anyway, but it will be Solo, a Star Wars Story. And, you know, I think Twitter was at the top of their game in making jokes about it, including all these Solo Cup jokes.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of a movie I'm more excited for.
Uh-huh.
Sean.
Yeah, I think we all are.
We got the full theatrical trailer for Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good God.
Yep.
Ryan Coogler is, he means business with this movie. This movie looks like a fucking movie.
It looks so fucking good. Like, we got those, like, little glimpses of it in sort of the teaser trailer in particular. Like, we got little glimpses of, like, the Wakanda city and all that stuff. But, like, just getting this full trailer, just, like, the art design of this movie and what they have, like, the direction they've decided to go in for, like, what Wakanda and that society and that technology and all that stuff looks like is so fucking amazing.
It's also, like, it is an unashamedly black movie.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you know, Ryan Coogler, you wouldn't hire him if you weren't going to let him do that, if you think of how, like, socially conscious his films are. And it's just such a cool thing in that, you know, I think you would expect the Hollywood Black Panther movie of 5 or 10 years ago, or frankly now, but by a different studio,
right,
would be, it would actually be about a white character who comes to Wakanda and, like, becomes Black Panther's friend.
It would be like, directed by a white guy.
Yeah.
And yeah, it would absolutely, it would be.
And it would be really toned down.
Yeah.
And it would be like, I'm a Black Panther, but I'm not angry. Like, that would be a line in the movie, and we would all go like, that was racist.
Yeah.
But, like, no, it's Black Panther, and, like, there are only two white actors we've seen in the cast or on the posters.
Yeah.
And one of them is the bad guy, and it's Andy Serkis. The other guy is Martin Freeman. Both have played hobbits. Well, like, or hobbit-esque characters.
Smeagol is technically a hobbit, and he did play Smeagol at the beginning of Return of the King, so he did play a hobbit.
Yes. But it's just like, like, that poster is just a amazing lineup of great, you know, modern black actors.
Yeah.
And just all the imagery in this film. Like, I just, that's something that, like, it has a cultural specificity that, you know, in this day and age, if you're going to do Black Panther, you have to do it. And I feel like Marvel has been learning that lesson. Like, they have that whole run that was done by, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates, which I really want to read. Have you read any of that?
No, I haven't read those comics.
Yeah, I'd love to take a look at those. But it just, it does, you know, Black Panther was obviously super important to a whole generation of young black, you know, artists and intellectuals.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it feels like Marvel is kind of giving the keys to that story over to them in different mediums, and that's cool.
Yeah. Because also thinking about, like the Black Panther comics, I know that Evan Narcissa, who's one of my favorite black writers in, he used to be at Kotaku, he's now, I think, at IO9 and mostly writes about comic books. He has also been writing, I don't think they have come out yet, but he announced that he's been writing a Black Panther origin like redux thing for Marvel as well.
That's cool.
Yeah, which is very cool. He's, if people do not know his writing, look up The Natural, which is an essay he did on black hair in video games, and it's very, very good.
Nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, just getting back to the trailer, though, there's so many cool moments. I love that we see more of the villain in the film. The other villain is played by Michael B. Jordan.
Right, yeah.
And he just... I love Michael B. Jordan. He looks awesome in this. I love when he transforms into, like, the evil Black Panther. That's just cool. Mm-hmm. The actual Black Panther costume, it's already in the running for best live-action superhero costume. Yes. It looks so cool. There's just so many cool things about it.
There's that cool, like, dream sequence-looking thing that's, like, this, like, crazy purple, yeah, like, African, you know, savanna.
All the actors just look perfect. It just, the use of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised as the song in, yeah, this. Just, it is a trailer that, like, means business, and it's great. Have you seen Creed yet?
No, I still haven't.
You should, yeah, see Creed, because that's Ryan Coogler's last film. And it's just, that's one of the things that fills me with excitement that, you know, because Creed is also, you know, it is... It's kind of like Black Panther in that it is ostensibly a mainstream, you know, big budget film, but Ryan Coogler took that opportunity to one, make a real fucking movie in terms of its artistry, but also tell a real, again, kind of socially conscious, like mildly political story where one of the undercurrents of Creed is it's about the legacy of black men without fathers. And that's one of the, right, things that the Michael B. Jordan character is going through in that movie, which leads to an absolute punch of the gut last scene. And then so many powerful things in that movie. And I love that, you know, he directs that and then gets Black Panther. You know, it does not feel like Marvel asking for the quote-unquote safe version of this movie.
Right.
And I love that.
But I do appreciate that they technically open the trailer with Martin Freeman as if to say, it's okay, white people. Like Martin Freeman's in this too. It's like the first line is from Martin Freeman. It's like,
I do.
You can watch this movie also because Martin Freeman's in it.
They did that with the first teaser, too, with Andy Serkis. And I like that there's something about that that's also kind of subversive to me of that, yeah, it's okay, white people, but also it's white people describing Wakanda and then, like, you know, the Black Panther coming and be like, I'll take it from here. Uh-huh. You don't know shit. And that was the whole point of this.
Yeah.
And let me show you some shit.
Yeah.
So just... The next Marvel movie is Thor Ragnarok, which could not look any more amazing if it tried.
Right,
and,
yeah,
and the reviews have already come out. It had... At the time of this taping, a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that that matters, but I don't think Marvel has ever gotten that.
Right, yeah.
So that's amazing. People are loving that film. And again, critics have never liked the Thor movies. Like, that's always been, like, Marvel's lowest on the totem pole critically. Mm-hmm. So that's just cool. Black Panther is next. Avengers Infinity War is next after that. We get Ant-Man, yeah, after that. We get Captain Marvel after that. Another, like, there's just, they have a lot of cool stuff coming.
Yeah, and it just feels like they're getting really good at this. Like, they're getting, like, especially off of, like, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and Spider-Man Homecoming and just, like, and Doctor Strange. Like, it feels like they're getting more creative and going further and further afield from, like, the core sort of, like, structure, you know, because it's, like, Spider-Man Homecoming is basically a teen comedy movie with a superhero thing, yeah, in it. You know, it's... Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is, like, a family drama with superhero shit in it.
Yeah, they've... It's just, it's a really enjoyable time to be a fan of this series because... You know, I totally understand the criticism from people who aren't into superhero movies that it all kind of feels the same in theaters. I get, if there's a genre you don't like and it's in theaters all the time, I get the frustration.
Right, yeah.
It's like critics who didn't like horror movies in the 80s, I feel for you. That's like all there was for months at a time, was, yeah, like six slasher films a month. But like, it is, I think as a fan of these movies, it doesn't feel like I'm seeing the same thing every time, especially now. Like Black Panther does not look like Guardians of the Galaxy, which,
yeah,
does not look like Spider-Man Homecoming, which does not look like Thor Ragnarok. This all just, it's a really exciting time to be a fan, especially if you like the characters and how much they're branching out,
yeah,
and that all these things can exist in the same world. Like, I love that, you know, they're making their cool Black Panther movie and going full on Wakanda, and they're not, like, relegating it to a side universe.
Right, yeah.
It's just part of the world.
Yeah, and it's just something that, you know, next year it will be the 10th year anniversary of
Jesus.
Iron Man, right? So
yeah,
it's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe thing has been going on for almost 10 years at this point. And it is, as someone who does enjoy these movies and also thinks, like, they're very interesting as, like, being the main, like, it feels like the cinematic, like, pop culture thing of the moment.
Uh-huh.
And it has been for a while. I think it's really cool to see that they have not, to me, become stagnant. Like, it feels like there are...
Less
like,
so over time.
Yeah, like, there was a moment there around Avengers 2 where it felt like, like, maybe this is not going to, like, go. But now it feels like they have, in the last year or two, they have given it this, like, extra push that's like, okay, yeah, there's definitely more stuff to do here.
Yeah. Thor Ragnarok is one of the upcoming podcasts I'm most looking forward to.
Oh, yeah. I just
fucking nerding out over that.
Need to see that movie.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about some sad news. As I said, some really big, kind of earth-shattering video game news that I think we expected parts of this story. The full impact of it, I don't think anyone could have predicted quite. Right.
And it's like complicated in a way that like it didn't need to be, and it is crazy like what EA did with this.
So, okay, the basic headline is that EA Electronic Arts has shuttered Visceral, which is one of their most notable development studios.
Yep.
Made games such as Dead Space.
It's the Dead Space franchise. Battlefield Hardline was the most, which didn't set the world on fire, but
yeah.
They've been around for a hot minute here. And also, like, you know, I played Dead Space 1. That's a really fucking good game.
Yeah, they had they were in development on a Star Wars game. That was kind of people's biggest question. That game's development has moved to EA Vancouver. Some of the team is going, some is not. They are, from what journalists have told us, not just EA, they are apparently starting more or less fresh on it. Amy Hennig, who is the director of the Uncharted trilogy, had been with Naughty Dog for a long time, left Naughty Dog during the development of Uncharted 4 and went to Visceral to work on this Star Wars project as like its lead, or its narrative lead. I don't know who is directing it. She is probably out.
Presumably.
Not like she's been fired from EA, but just we presume she's not in that game and might move on. I don't think she probably knows what her future is fully, because this seems sudden to everyone. And that's a big deal. You know, this isn't like EA shuttering, BioWare Montreal or whoever made Mass Effect Andromeda. That was like a studio built for that game that was kind of an offshoot anyway.
Yeah.
The game didn't work. Those people were just sent elsewhere.
And BioWare itself still exists. Don't get me wrong, like it's tragic for all those people who lost their jobs, but there's a difference between shutting down like one team at a studio and shutting down this entire studio,
which was pretty prominent in the video game landscape of the last generation.
Yeah, and it was like one of EA's most acclaimed internal studios that they had other than BioWare.
Yeah. So, Sean, what other like complications do we want to talk about? What reactions do we have?
Yeah.
I think most people are focusing on the Star Wars stuff, but it's also shocking that like they had ongoing successful franchises too. We had a long conversation last week about Star Wars Battlefront 2 and the history of Star Wars, or the future of Star Wars at EA, which I actually think was a really good foundation for this conversation, sadly. I think one of my initial reactions, though, is that I think Star Wars is a bigger deal to EA than we knew, and I think their plans for it kind of terrify me.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff to talk here, because the other thing that happened is that shortly after the news came out that they shut down Visceral, EA companies that news are specifically Patrick Soderlund, who's like the executive vice president or something like that, very high up at EA, issued this whole statement that I'm going to read maybe just selections from later to accompany it, which is like this statement is crazy, and we'll get to that in a second, because I think this is what, if you've been following a lot of like the reactions in the gaming press, has been mostly going off of this statement. But when I first saw this news, I was like, you know, as anyone sees news these days, I saw it on Twitter. And honestly, like, my first reaction was like, yeah, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was, I just had this immediate flashback to, like, podcasts from this E3, podcasts from last E3, and podcasts from two E3s ago, of like, our podcasts of, like, where the fuck is this game? Where is it? And it was something I feel like we have a tragic track record, accurate track record on this podcast now, of looking at EA stuff at EA E3s and saying, this looks like you have no idea what you're doing. Like, this looks like you don't have video games, and you keep on saying you have video games, but you're not marketing them, you're not showing them, you're not making trailers, you're not putting out like demos for the press. You just keep on telling us that you're making these video games, showing us footage of people that you're telling us are making these video games. But you're not like actually pitching these to us. And lo and behold, like Mass Effect Andromeda came out and was an entire disaster. And I suspect that that's probably one of the biggest contributing reasons.
I was going to say that.
To why this got shut down is that I don't think EA is in a position to have a second Mass Effect Andromeda.
Because here's the thing I think was going to happen, is that Mass Effect Andromeda came out on not just unfinished, but in a state where it still had not been like demoed to press.
Right.
Because it was never even that close to finish. But they decided, bottom line, we got to get it out. And I think that probably would have happened to this Star Wars game. And they said, well, if we do that, then we will have had a Star Wars flop of that kind of design. Again, remember, Mass Effect Andromeda is in now. Last week, it was only $9.99 on Amazon. It is now in EA Access. It is a free game in their subscription service.
Yes, and it came out in March or April this year.
March,
yeah.
It came out the same time as Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. It's, you know, it is in, like, my brother paid full price for that game.
Full.
And I feel, and he is seething at that a little bit. He enjoyed it enough, but, you know, you could get it for free now.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, and so this Star Wars game, I think there's, like, something important to keep in mind before I go into this whole statement and, like, what this statement implies, is that this is a game that has been in development for 3 to 4 years. Like, it was in development before Amy Hennig went on. Like, once Amy Hennig left, like, she became, like, a narrative director or something, and there was already a game director from Visceral that was working on the game. And, like, the only things we kind of knew about it was that it was going to be a vaguely Uncharted-like sort of game, that it was going to star a character that was not a Jedi, it was going to be a linear, sort of single-player action-adventure kind of game, that I think they, like, said that on, like, an E3 press conference. It's the only way we basically know any of that stuff. We never saw the title of this game that has been in development for, like, 3 to 4 years, and we never got a trailer. The closest thing we got was in one of those video packages from E3 2 years ago, where they were showing, like, people, like, making the video games, and this is also where we basically got some of our first look at actual Mass Effect Andromeda that wasn't a cinematic teaser, in that whole video package of people, like, you know, working on, like, environment artists, on, like, working on, like, mesh environments or something. It looks so early on. And from that video, the only footage we have ever seen of this game is one GIF of a dude walking out of a building into, like, a Tatooine-looking, like, Mos Eisley-esque city where there's a Star Destroyer in the sky and some, like, First Order banners on the walls. And that's the only thing we've seen from this video game that's been in development for 3 to 4 years. And it's like, that was enough for me to, when this news came out that EA was shutting down Visceral. EA, also a studio that has a history of shutting down full game studios instead of, like, doing something else and moving them onto other projects. I was very not surprised by this news, even though I think it's tragic in a lot of ways, and that Visceral is a studio that has a lot of great history. I'm sure there are a lot of amazing people like working there. Amy Hennig is obviously a really talented game director and game designer, and I hope she gets back on her feet onto another project soon enough, because, like, this is obviously set back that work.
Oh God, I mean, this is two games in a row for her.
Yeah.
It sucks, and you know, we were happy with where Uncharted 4 went, and maybe it was for the best. Well, you know, who knows? But I just want to see another game from her. She's too important a voice in the industry to keep have her projects taken out at the knees.
Yeah. It's like, all that really fucking sucks. But every indication from reporting that Jason Schreier, you know, we've talked about it pretty recently on this podcast, because he also wrote Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, which talks a lot about Amy Hennig moving from Uncharted 4. It also talks a lot about the shuttering of LucasArts and Star Wars 1313, which contains an incredibly ominous section that is even more ominous now, I'm sure, where some of the people working on Star Wars 1313, which was the Star Wars game that got shut down when Disney did the buyout, pitched their game to Visceral once EA got the rights to make Star Wars games, and Visceral basically said, like, no, like, sorry, we might hire some of you guys to work on Visceral, but we're going to make our own Star Wars game. It's like, I'm sorry, but you're not. Like, this, it's almost like the vengeful spirit of Star Wars 1313 killed this game or something.
I mean, we have to talk about that two super high-profile Star Wars games got canceled.
Yeah.
And if you can't get a Star Wars game out, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
It's Star Wars.
Yeah, so anyways, but, like, just so, like, Jason Schreier at Kotaku basically has said, I've been hearing rumors for quite some time now that Visceral Star Wars game was in trouble, and that studios across EA were brought in to help give it vision and direction. Now that game is no more. So basically, like, all reporting indicates that, yes, like, this project was severely troubled, and that is the reason why it was shut down. But something else happened that set the game industry ablaze, and particularly the press industry ablaze, is this statement that EA put out along with the news of them shutting down Visceral. I'm curious, Jonathan, have you read this?
I'm sure I've seen the clips. I have not read the whole thing.
Yeah, so I'm just going to read this. I think I might just read the whole thing, because it's not that long. And it's just really interesting to me, and we can kind of break this down, because I think there's a lot to talk about here. So this is from Patrick Soderlund at EA. Our industry is evolving faster and more dramatically than ever before. The games we want to play and spend time with, the experiences we want to have in those games, and the way we play, all those things are continually changing. So is the way games are made. In this fast-moving space, we are always focused on creating experiences that our players want to play, and today that means we're making a significant change with one of our upcoming titles. Significant change.
It's one way to say it.
Yeah. Our Visceral Studio has been developing an action-adventure title set in the Star Wars universe. In its current form, it was shaping up to be a story-based linear adventure game. Throughout the development process, we have been testing the game concept with players, listening to the feedback about what and how they want to play, and closely tracking fundamental shifts in the marketplace. It has become clear that to deliver an experience that players will want to come back to and enjoy for a long time to come, we needed to pivot the design, which pivot is the word that people have sort of pulled from this
press release. I think this is among the more terrifying paragraphs in video game history.
It's a whole fucking thing, buddy. It goes on. We will maintain the stunning visuals, authenticity in the Star Wars universe, and focus on bringing a Star Wars story to life. Importantly, we are shifting the game to a broader experience that allows for more variety and player agency, leaning into the capabilities of our Frostbite engine, which if you have read Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, you know a whole lot about the Frostbite engine and maybe have a good idea about why this game had a lot of trouble development, and Mass Effect Andromeda did, and reimagining central elements of the game to give players a Star Wars adventure of greater depth and breadth to explore. This move leads to a few other changes. A development team, this is like where they talk about that EA Worldwide Studios and EA Vancouver are going to take over the project. This is such a crazy sentence. Lastly, while we had originally expected this game to launch late in our fiscal year of 2019, that was their internal projection for the Visceral developed Star Wars game, was going to be late fiscal year 2019, which could technically be 2020. Like, it's fucking 2017. This game has been in development since at least 2014. It's fucking crazy that was like their projection for it. We're now looking at a new time frame that we will announce in the future, which I like how vague that is, that there's a potential in that statement of new time frame that's like, we're actually just going to shit this thing out in like 6 months in this new format. That's an entire possibility. Bringing new Star Wars games to life for every passionate fan out there is what drives us as creators. This is a funny thing to say when you have literally just killed the studio that is making a Star Wars game. It is what has inspired us to deliver the massive new Star Wars Battlefront 2 experience launching in just a few weeks. It fuels our live service in Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes. Making games in the extraordinary Star Wars universe is truly a dream for so many of us at EA. And many of us also that are no longer at EA, and we have so many more experiences to come for players on every platform. We want to take the time to get each game right, to make it unique, to make it amazing. We look forward to answering more of your questions and sharing more on our plans and timeline for this new Star Wars experience in the months to come.
Okay. Can I give two initial thoughts?
Yes, there's a lot to unpack from this thing.
First initial thought. Nowhere in that statement does it explain why the troubled development of one game made you take a shotgun to the head of the entire studio.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, seems like an overreaction. Yeah. You know, like one of your longest, loyalist studios that had other things they could make.
Yeah.
Like another Dead Space, or what was the other one they did?
Battlefield Hardline. They could make another Battlefield game or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, you know, you took a shotgun to the head of the whole thing. That's a little weird. That seems extreme. You know, it seems like blowing up the house because it had termites in it.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
That's one thing. Two, in the second paragraph, the most terrifying paragraph in recent video game history, they don't want a normal single-player video game. They want Star Wars Destiny. Mm-hmm. And if this is the future of major AAA video games, I want to blow my head off.
And that is what a lot of people in the gaming press have come away from with this statement. And I totally get that, because it is the most... it's the most, like, classic EA fucking, like, insanity of just, like...
because the thing about players weren't feeling it. It's, no, Destiny sold a lot. The Division got a lot of hype and other games like that. And you were like, we could make more money this way.
Yeah.
And people play single-player games until they're done. They don't get addicted to it like crack cocaine.
Yeah. And put a slot machine in our video game to keep pumping money out of them.
We don't want an artistic video game. We want black tar heroin with pixels.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just like, it is that this sentence of, we have been testing the game concept with players, which is just a weird fucking sentence for a game that's been in development for 3 to 4 years, is we have been testing the game concept? Like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, have you gone up to people and said, would you like a, like, high-quality, high-budget, single-player Star Wars game where you play as a Han Solo-like figure? Because I feel like most people would be like, yeah, that sounds pretty good, right? Like, that's not like a tragic game concept that's never going to get off the ground. Listening to the feedback about what and how they want to play, and closely tracking fundamental shifts in the marketplace. That's one of the key clauses that people have
put out. Tell Naughty Dog about those fundamental shifts in the marketplace, and tell Sony, like, hey, your flagship studio is only making single-player games. They must be a massive failure, right? You're going to shutter them any day now. Or have Last of Us Destiny 2.
Yeah. So that's where... Like for my sort of take on a lot of this stuff is that, and Jason Schreier had a tweet, I think a day after this came out, that to me, like, this is my go-to off of this, is he says, I feel like I should clarify that despite today's hot takes, Visual's game was not canned because it was single player, despite what EA is saying. That's me editorializing. From what Jason Schreier has heard, then one gentleman asks him on Twitter, so the EA exec makes a weird statement, then why? And Jason Schreier says, because investors don't like hearing the project was a mess. So that to me is my real takeaway from this, is that single player games are not in danger. Like especially if you look at this year, like this fucking year where I'm playing Neo right now. I mean, most of the games I played this year have all been single player games. I've been playing Neo. Like, Nier Automata sold multiple millions of copies, which is a game that would never fucking do that. It's single player only. Like, Resident Evil 7 has sold like 4 million copies. You know, you had Horizon Zero Dawn was a massive success. Legend of Zelda was obviously massive success.
The entire success of the Nintendo Switch, and then it's selling like utter hotcakes, and everything on the platform is selling like hotcakes, and they don't have big multiplayer games other than Splatoon 2.
Yeah. And ARMS. Don't forget about ARMS. I mean, the whole world forgot about ARMS, but they made that one also.
Yes.
But Super Mario Odyssey is on the horizon from Nintendo. Also, the same day as Super Mario Odyssey is a sequel to a single-player-only first-person shooter from 2014 that is also a single-player-only first-person shooter in Wolfenstein 2. That's like the most multiplayer genre that basically exists is the fucking first-person shooter. And still, there's like Wolfenstein The New Order was obviously successful enough as a single-player-only first-person shooter to warrant getting a sequel.
The only thing I would parse with this, you're absolutely right that I think the actual market trends are that people just like good games.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can't deny that the big AAA companies are also chasing whatever kind of thing they can do that will be a game that people are, that is designed for people to play every day and spend their microtransactions in and have constant hype. And, like, I don't think there's an actual real world marketplace where we can support a ton of those games.
No, because they're too competitive.
But people are constantly searching for that.
I just feel like I have been hearing that, like, single player games are dead since like 2007. Like
I don't think they're dead, but I think it's kind of like when the studios were all thinking console gaming is dead, despite I don't think there was the actual evidence for that before the new generation, but they started thinking this. I do think there is probably a sect of the corporate culture, because shareholders who don't play or talk about video games think that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely, like, there are, I mean, because, like, yeah, this EA statement does not come from nowhere. Like, it definitely speaks to some of their philosophy, and, like, Star Wars Battlefront 2, is exemplary of that. Although, also, a thing to note, fucking Star Wars Battlefront 2 has a single-player campaign, and Star Wars Battlefront 1 did not, because people wanted a single-player campaign from that game, and so they put it into the sequel. And I think, like, for me, this statement, because... Also, this kind of statement, like this big, I mean, this is like one, two, three, four, five, basically six paragraphs. A six-paragraph statement coming out from EA, officially from EA, from an executive at EA, about the shuttering of the studio. You never hear this. Like, this is insane. I've never seen any fucking, like, huge, like, company anywhere have a statement like this that is talking about how we have seen fundamental shifts in the marketplace and that's why we're shutting. Like, they would just say, you know, like, for financial purposes, blah, 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 we have, regrettably, to, you know, shut down Visceral Studios and the project is being moved to EA Vancouver. Like, and that would be, it would be two sentences at most, right? If not just one sentence as the official statement from EA about this. Instead, you have this whole thing, and I think to me, this whole thing reads like, so kind of like what Jason Schreier is saying, that like they can't afford to, like, EA is a publicly traded company. They can't afford to let all their stockholders know that, like, not only did Mass Effect Andromeda was that an entire shit show, that, like, one of the only other significant games we have in development that's not a sports title is also in the same fucking boat. They can't do that.
No, you know, and you're
they
right.
can't just say, we fucked up the two biggest games we've been working on for 3 years. We've totally fucked this thing, guys.
I think EA is in a really interesting, precarious position.
Yeah,
though.
Definitely.
I think Mass Effect Andromeda has changed the game for them in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the highest profile failures we've had in the last decade. I mean,
yeah.
it's the AAA games like that don't bomb like that usually.
Mm-hmm.
That high profile. Or if they do, they dust themselves off and come back next year like Assassin's Creed after Unity, you know?
Yeah, because even then, like, Assassin's Creed Unity, even if it was critically panned in a lot of ways, it still sold perfectly fine.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And Andromeda obviously did it because there was enough surplus inventory that you can get one on Amazon for a nickel.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, it's...
Like, they're giving it away for free. Like, it's an add-on item if you're buying something else.
Yes, it's nuts. I mean, that is kind of, I think, unprecedented, for especially for that kind of game. I look at this, I look at their Star Wars, the Battlefront stuff, and I think they're scrambling around that. I think EA is a studio that, you know, they have their sports on lockdown, and they have some other things here and there, but I think whatever identity they had a couple years ago, you know, in the heyday of the BioWare days and stuff like that, I think has really dissipated. We'll see if Anthem can bring that back
right
there. But then there's also, I think, they have the biggest license in the world in Star Wars. And I think it is totally possible we could see that license eat them alive.
Yeah.
In that, you know, again, we talked about this last week. It shouldn't be... It's not that it's easy to make video games. But it shouldn't be that hard to figure out what people want from Star Wars. Which
right
is just go make a good Star Wars game. And I don't mean that to sound flippant, but people have been doing it for 30 years.
Yeah.
And it just means give it to game designers and let them make a game out of it. And I don't know what went with this. It could have been very organic fuck-ups. It could have been corporate, you know, meandering fuck-ups. I don't know what it was. But Battlefront is this thing with no identity, and I don't think any real strong sales potential in terms of how long it will survive. You have this. They're going to transition to something else. Who knows? Star Wars has already killed one studio at EA. And we're only 2 years in to this license. It's nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I would just encourage people to maybe temper what they take from this and don't just buy into the 1 million hot take think pieces that came out the day after the statement of that, oh, single player video games are dead.
Yeah, but, no, I don't think that. I do think it's an interesting window into the corporate mindset that,
sure,
sort of like a few years ago when the Wii U was starting to struggle for Nintendo, and we heard all this stuff about how Nintendo shareholders were pressuring Nintendo to just move to cell phone games,
right,
and they started doing that. And again, that's not because I think Nintendo believed that was the way forward. Clearly, they knew the way, and they're fine now, and I don't think anyone's pressuring them to make cell phone games, and they're probably going to back off on that,
sure,
to some degree. Like, we have not heard about the Animal Crossing one, you know? But, like, there's this thing when you're a publicly traded company that people who don't actually know your business own you.
Right, yeah.
It's a weird thing.
Yeah. But thinking about, like, the future single-player games, like, one other point that we've talked about this a little bit already because it's sort of an interesting trend this year, but I think we have seen a direction forward for AAA studios in making single-player-focused experiences this year, specifically with Uncharted Lost Legacy and then Hellblade, which is, I still need to fucking get around to playing Hellblade at some point here soon. But, like, having a smaller, more focused experience that is, like, budget-titled from these big studios, that if, like, if that's what you're going to do for a single player game, like, yeah, like, make it like 3 to 6, 8 hour single player only campaign and put it out at like a smaller price with like having a smaller team develop it, but you can still have, you know, all these like bigger resources that a big studio has and make something that is more at that AAA level of quality. I think there's real potential for that, like, going forward to being like, not only like that's where we get some of those more focused linear kind of single player games, but also I think they honestly benefit from that approach because they don't have to be these huge bloated experiences that have to put all this shit in to justify being a $60 game.
God, if I were EA, get 10 people together and have them start working on that for Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know? Like, just to start, you know, because that could be a small thing that could grow into something so much bigger. I'm not saying it would take 10 people to finish the game, but you could start with a team like that.
Yeah.
They've got the manpower. I don't know. It's whatever this, you know, and who knows what this project will turn into. Everything we've heard from Beyond is that they are scrapping the whole thing and starting over, maybe with some things they've done in the engine.
Yeah, there might be, like, I assume they're going to take some of the art assets and stuff like that, and maybe some of the story ideas, but it's certainly this thing sounds a lot like they are scrapping everything about like what the game actually is and putting it into a totally different business model at the very least.
It's nuts. Also, Frostbite is the other thing that might eat EA alive.
Yeah.
Because this is, I mean, Jesus Christ, how many times does it have to happen before you learn your fucking lesson?
Right.
Which is Dragon Age Inquisition was almost brought to its knees by this engine and made it out the door, luckily, and is a good, really good game.
Yeah.
Mass Effect Andromeda, one of the things that killed that game was Frostbite. What was the other game we were mentioning that just...
I mean, this one.
This one, yeah. This one.
This is obviously, being made off of on Frostbite.
And which... that could have been one of the... If read Jason Schreier's book and why the engine matters... All the creative ideas could have been great, and that could have been one of the big things that just made it a mess to build. You know?
It's just...
Because Frostbite was made for something very different than they're asking it to be used for in all these different scenarios.
It was made specifically for Battlefield games, and that's basically it. Like, it was made by DICE Studios that makes Battlefield, and it seems like it's a real great engine for Battlefield and Battlefront, and for nothing else. And if you're trying to do anything else with it... It sounds like there are.
Do we know what hurdles. Anthem is being built in?
I assume it's Frostbite. I mean, okay. EA, that's like EA's thing, is that they decided at the beginning of this generation, like, we're going to have DICE, we're going to use your engine, and we're going to use your engine for everything, instead of having to license out our engine to a third party, like Unreal Engine from Epic or something.
It's just, it's very weird. Like, and we have not heard, like, development horror stories from Anthem, but we haven't heard much from Anthem at all. We haven't heard anything.
Like, we've seen one trailer.
Who knows? Because, God, if Anthem also is having trouble because of Frostbite, again, at a certain point, it could just eat the studio alive.
I mean, at the very least, we have a title for Anthem and, like, a trailer with the gameplay demo, which is literally more than we've ever gotten for the Star Wars game, so...
EA is just in a very weird scenario, and, yeah, again, shuttering the whole studio because of this Star Wars game just feels, like, weirdly vindictive. It would be like if Battlefront 2 undersold, so they just got rid of DICE.
And then they're left with nothing. They're left with Madden and like the Madden license, NHL games, FIFA, and like their crappy NFL or NBA games that nobody likes.
Yeah,
always a good place in 2K1. It's like, yeah, I'm just curious like what next year's E3 is, because I feel like with EA and E3, it has been this story for like this whole generation of every single E3. I've come away from that press conference going, where are all your video games that aren't fucking sports games? This is insane. And it turns out none of those games are coming out except for fucking like Battlefront and Battlefield. That's the, like, DICE is the only studio they have that is not making sports games that is actually fucking putting out video games.
It's... And that just is not sustainable. Like, these Star Wars games are going to have to make a lot of money to make up for years and years of development.
Yeah, and I think that's where you get this, like, well, we need to put all these fucking microtransactions in there.
Yeah.
Because if you're not... If you only have, like, 3 fucking video games you put out, you have to have some, like, extra source of revenue, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I think that the budget price single-player things from, like, Sony and Ninja Theory are smart, is because it, like, you have a broader portfolio as a company that you can have... You know, projects that come out that are smaller risk and smaller return, but you need some of that to be a successful fucking company. Like, that's basic economics. But so much of both, like, the movie industry and the video game industry is based off of this idea that, like, you have these ridiculous multi-$100 million projects that if they do not make, like, an absurd amount of money back, then they flop, and that's the only thing this company puts out. That's not a sustainable business model. It's an insane way to run a business.
It's weird because, you know, this generation, which we are now, you know, firmly in the middle of, has come into maturity in such interesting ways, where it had, I think, a pretty rocky start in year 1 and 2, and it has gradually, like, the games we're playing now don't feel like the games of 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But in ways I don't think we could have expected. It's in subtle, interesting, nuanced ways, like, you know, how much I think single-player games like you're talking about have come to the forefront, how much the revival of, like, Japanese gaming industry, and how I think the success of the PS4 has facilitated a lot of that coming over here. Now you have, I think, the healthier competition again, in that Nintendo has roared back, and Xbox has... The Xbox One X, I don't know if they have firm footing as a game developer, but, you know, there's some interesting things going on with all that. And yet there are parts of the industry that feel so left behind, and one of those is EA. Like, EA feels like it is, you know, a dog trying to learn new tricks, and it cannot come along for the ride.
Yeah. It just feels like somehow they just failed to make the transition to this generation of consoles, which happens every now and then. Like, sometimes they're just studios that just that's like kind of like THQ and the 360 and PS3 generations. Like, there's this third party developer that like and like publisher that had like was built off of this sort of like B game kind of thing in the PS2 and the Xbox generation, and like for like love like way earlier than that. And they kept on trying to find a foothold in the 360 and PS3 generation, but the bottom fell out of that like whole tier of games, and they just went along with it. It was like this storied publisher that had made hundreds of video games for decades and just gone. And like, I don't think EA is just going to disappear, because I think like Madden like and FIFA sell too well for that to just happen. And like, I think are the only people that that company has that fucking license. And until those deals run out, NFL and FIFA can't go anywhere else, right, for video games.
But I do think EA could look really different in 5 years.
Yeah, like they might really downsize and become like, I can see a future where EA just basically becomes the studio that makes sports games. And like, if DICE is not at EA, if like something happens with DICE, they basically have nothing else.
I could see BioWare getting into a Bungie situation at some point where they negotiate some independence and go to someone else.
Yeah.
It's interesting, because like, you know, and Activision is one where they've done a really interesting job of making that. You know, it's not that the ship is too big to move. We've seen other people navigate those waters. But yeah, EA is an interesting one. It's always been the outlier these last couple of years.
Yeah. So, you know,
interesting stuff.
Yeah. You know, pour one out for all the, you know, those people that were working at Visceral. I hope they find good jobs and stay in the game industry, and hope they're not like just like kicked out and say like, fuck all this shit, because it would be an understandable reaction. But I want to see more stuff from these people, because they're talented.
Indeed. And that might be the most callous thing about the whole statement you read, is that it's not about them, and it doesn't really express any regret about having to do that.
Yeah, it does suck that there's no sort of like corporate speak of like, we have to downsize. There's no other alternative. They don't even like pay attention to that. They're just like, yeah, we're shutting down Visceral and giving this project to EA Vancouver because of fundamental shifts in the marketplace, and we're pivoting, blah, blah, blah. It's like, fuck off.
Pivot. Should we pivot to another discussion, Sean?
Let's pivot from talking about the business of video games to talking about the fucking video games, Jonathan.
Will we have microtransactions in this conversation?
Not if there isn't any in Fire Emblem Musou, because there certainly aren't any in Neo.
There are not.
Very good.
That I know of. Okay, so who should go first?
Do you want me to go first? Do you want to go first? I don't know.
I'll go first.
Okay.
Why not? You might have more thoughts on Neo too, because sure. I know I've been playing Fire Emblem Warriors for 3 days. You've been playing Neo for two weeks.
Yeah.
So Fire Emblem Warriors came out on Friday, and I played it a lot on Friday, Saturday, a little bit today. The game has, to my understanding, 20 chapters in the story mode, and I'm on chapter 13, I think. So I'm a good distance in. In addition to the story mode, there's also what's called history mode, which is like other maps that are not connected to the story that you can play, and I haven't really gotten into that. So there's a lot more to do, but I'm a good distance into the campaign, and I definitely have a feel for it. Fire Emblem Warriors, if you don't know, is the Fire Emblem crossover with the Dynasty Warriors, not series like the story, but like the basic gameplay of it.
Yeah, the style of game, like, you know, it was also, what was the Zelda one? Like
Hyrule Warriors.
Hyrule Warriors, yeah. So it's like Nintendo had done this once before with Hyrule Warriors, and then like Bandai Namco makes, which actually like they also made Neo, makes a billion fucking one of these sorts of, they're called Musou games because the title in Japan is Sangoku Musou, so that's why I kind of think of them that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, they have like Samurai Warriors, and there's like Warriors Orochi, that is like a whole crossover thing. There's a whole fucking...
Is Dragon Quest Heroes one of these?
Dragon Quest Heroes is one of them. Yes, there's a Berserk one based on the Berserk manga that came out like 2 years ago or something. They just make a lot of these fucking games.
They do. But the thing is, I had never played a Musou or Warriors game before this. And I love Fire Emblem. Y'all know that. I talk about it enough.
Yeah.
Fire Emblem is great. It's another entry for the Switch, and the Switch is, you know, really interesting, great first year. And it was a different kind of game for the Switch. It's another one that kind of shows a different side of the system, I think. So it was one I wanted to pick up, with the only hesitation being, why are they putting this out Friday before Mario?
Right.
It's a little weird, but I did want to get it. And I am enjoying the hell out of it so far.
Awesome.
It's really good. It's kind of interesting. There are no major like American reviews of the game I've seen in like the biggest publications.
Huh.
Like some smaller sites I've seen have had some. Definitely European sites have, because it's been out longer. So like there's not a ton of writing on it just yet. So I'm not really sure what the general critical reaction to this game is. I can just say I like it. My general reaction is... one of the big questions here, of course, would be, how does it use the Fire Emblem license, right?
Sure,
because the whole reason for this game's existence is it has to be a good Musou game, right?
Right.
Otherwise, it has no reason for being. But it also has to do something interesting enough with Fire Emblem to make Fire Emblem fans play it. Because if you just want to play a Warriors game, there are plenty of options.
Yes, there are a lot. I would recommend Dynasty Warriors 8 Extreme Legends. You can get it on the PS4 or on the PC.
Okay, nice. And so, yeah, you could do that. You could go back to Hyrule Warriors. Like, there's so many things you could do. I think the question does come down to, you know, Fire Emblem is in this really interesting renaissance where it's suddenly become one of Nintendo's most profitable series, so it's getting spin-offs and new games up the ass. I mean, this is the second major Fire Emblem game of the year, and not counting the smartphone one that has manipulated a lot of people into giving a lot of money.
That one is called Fire Emblem Heroes.
It's hard to remember.
Yes, because there's Dragon Quest Heroes, which is a Warriors game. Fire Emblem Heroes is not a Warriors game because Fire Emblem Warriors is the Warriors game.
Indeed. I hope that made sense to everyone at home.
It made sense. That's why I just call it Musou. Yeah. That's easier to keep straight.
No, totally. So the question is, you know, how does it function to Fire Emblem fans? And I would call myself a pretty big Fire Emblem fan. And I think it works really well, asterisk, which is that there's kind of two sides to how it makes use of Fire Emblem as a franchise. One is in the story it chooses to tell, how it writes the characters. That part of the game is terrible.
I have
almost no good things to say about it. The writing is very bad. The story is very bad. It's what you would expect from the story, which is that dimensional portals have opened, and heroes from different Fire Emblem games are meeting, and they fight, and then they become friends, and then they go off and fight more Fire Emblem characters, and they meet and become friends, and there's a dragon they have to kill by getting all their friends together.
It's like, I know that it's really, really hard to do, and honestly, like, I can't come up with a different way to do it. Someday, someone has to find a different way to justify a, like, cross-franchise fucking, like, crossover thing of where you're taking all these people from different eras and stuff. That's not just, like, dimensional portals open up and, like, people get sucked into them. It's just, like, there are a billion of these stories. Like fucking Marvelous Capcom Infinite came out earlier this year, and I was watching some videos of that because I was just curious what the story and plot of that was. It was just, like, fucking have... Someone needs to come up with a different way to do this, because they've been doing this since I was, like, you know, since the 90s, at least with comics and shit.
This is the third game this year on the Switch I've played with that premise.
Right.
You have Puyo Puyo Tetris, where the Puyo Puyo and Tetris characters meet in a dimensional portal. And that one's actually a pretty fun story, so it's fine. It's a weird, like, visual novel, you know, like, satire kind of thing. Not satire, but, like, spoof almost.
Right.
It's really fun. Mario vs. Rabbids Kingdom Battle. Mario plus Rabbids, which I think is probably the best of these crossovers because it just... I mean, it's completely silly and it's so self-aware. The rabbits get sucked into our world through a washing machine. Like, you know, that one I think knows it's a dumb trope. This one does not seem self-aware enough about the trope. It's... The other thing that's weird in terms of how it uses the story is... So they focused on, like... There are characters from some other games, but the main three casts are Fire Emblem Awakening, Fire Emblem Fates, and Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon, which is either the original Famicom game or the DS remake. So those are like the
three
major
games.
That's
where Marth is from, right?
Yep.
The original Marth.
Yeah, Marth is from that. Fates is obviously Fates, Birthright, and Conquest, the two versions. And so you have all the two families from Nor and Hoshido. And then Awakening, you have the big ones. You have Crom and Frederick and Robin and everyone. So you have those sets of characters. And I think it's probably smart overall to sort of limit where they're coming from, especially if you're trying to tell a story with them. And I totally understand, like, some people probably want more from older Fire Emblem games.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There is something to be said for probably why they did it is, one, Fates and Awakening have sold the most of any Fire Emblem game.
Yeah.
And two, like, modern character models and animations exist for those characters, and they have voices. Like, you don't have to go to the drawing board on those.
Okay.
There are characters from Lynn from Fire Emblem on the GBA.
Yeah!
I have not met her yet.
Oh.
But I will tell you, I mean, she's all over the special edition packaging, which I can talk about
soon. Okay, there we go.
So she's clearly in it somewhere. They're saving the best for last. I also have not met the Shadow Dragon characters yet, so there's still a ways to go. And there is someone, Celica from Fire Emblem Gaiden, which was remade this year as Fire Emblem Echoes on the 3DS, is in it as well. So, you know... you can express this point. I get it. I like Awakening and Fates. I love those games, actually. Fates less so, but Awakening was my first Fire Emblem. So I get it, and it's fine, and I am excited to see Marth and some of the older characters when I get there. My problem with all that, though, is that the story they've chosen to tell and focusing around that is that when you get to those characters, like, there's no... This isn't like Persona Q, where through the dimensional portal the characters are sucked out of their own timelines.
Right.
And like everything that's... like Shinji has just died in... No, he's not. He's about to die. So he and Ken have some interesting stuff going on. But there's like... the characters are in a moment in their story.
Right.
They didn't do that here. So like the Awakening characters are just, I guess, one day before the real shit in Awakening goes down, sucked in. And weird stuff happens, and then they wind up having to rehash beats from Awakening. Like, one of the stuff, some of the stuff in Awakening is that, like, Lucina, who you know is the blue-haired girl who's really cool, she's Crom's daughter from the future who comes back in time in Awakening, and all the children do because the future is, like, broken.
Right.
So, in Awakening, it's all really cool, but we still have to get the scene here where Lucina is pretending to be a character named Marth, and she takes her mask off, and Crom realizes she's his daughter, and they have the heart-to-heart. But it's not, it's written by, I presume, people who have never worked on Fire Emblem before, and in a setting where this is never going to go anywhere, so I'm just like, oh god, just stop talking and let me play. Like, it's there's scenes like that. When you get to the Fire Emblem Fates stuff, I think it works a little better, because you have the built-in Nor versus Hoshido stuff, and the game actually branches there, and you have to play, like, a set of Nor scenarios and a set of Hoshido scenarios, and they come back together. And there is some fun stuff with that, but it's still the general problem of, like, the characters are mad because they think the other side captured Corrin, the protagonist from that game. It's like, that's what Fire Emblem Fates was all about. I've seen it, I've played it twice, and there's a third campaign I paid for that I still haven't finished because I've already put 80 hours into that game. So, like, there's just, that kind of stuff is kind of a baffling choice to me.
Yeah.
That, again, I understand the impulse to limit the casts the way they did, but if this is what your idea was for the story, I would just have soon have just taken the best Fire Emblem characters, they're all together, you don't need to explain it, and there's a dragon they have to go fight.
Like, yeah. Or it's just, like, if you're going to do that, you might as well just, like, set your game in the display. Like, here's, like, Fire Emblem's Awakening campaign where you go through the major beats of that game's story from this whole other, like, perspective or something, and there's, like, a free mode where you can play as all the different characters. Like, if you're just going to rehash all of those main story beats, you might as well put them in the main story instead of doing this weird crossover thing.
And it's really weird, and the other thing is that in terms of the writing, like, you know, the same team has developed three major Fire Emblem games since 2013, Awakening, Fates, and Echoes. And we know that team's voice really well, and those are three very accomplished, interesting games, and I feel like, you know, Fire Emblem has this very kind of authorial presence to it. This game is clearly not written by those people. So, like, the characters don't sound right to me, not the voices, but, like, the writing.
Right.
It doesn't seem interesting. It just doesn't feel on a writing level really like Fire Emblem. You get moments like that. But yeah, if you're coming to this for more Fire Emblem story, this is not the game for you.
Okay.
However, if you are coming to this to mow down vast, endless fields of enemies as Fire Emblem characters, and to hear really cool rock guitar renditions of Fire Emblem music, and to play this interesting mashup where the Musou games have implemented a lot of the strategic elements of Fire Emblem games in ways I was not expecting, but makes it very interesting, this is absolutely the game for you.
Okay.
So, again, using the Fire Emblem license to summarize, on a story level, crap. On a gameplay level, out-fucking-standing. Like, enough that I very much would recommend this game, because at the end of the day with this kind of thing, I don't know, I don't really care about the story. Right. I just want to get out there on my cool horse dude and mow down fields of enemies. Because if you don't know, in the Musou series, you mow down a lot of enemies.
Yes.
And I say mow down, and you're not using guns. I assume there's one of them. But, like, yeah, no, you are taking your sword and launching 300 people into the air and killing them all at once.
Yeah, it is not uncommon at the end of a, like, you know, come match or whatever you want to call it, of a Dynasty Warriors type game, where your kill count is literally in the thousands.
Oh, no, yeah. There is in one of the, like, achievements in each of the levels, to get, like, an unlockable in the game is to clear 1,000. And so I've done that on every map. And I had one the other night where it was really long and hard and interesting, and it went above 3,000.
Yeah.
That's insane. And so the basic stuff from what, and again, I have not played other Warriors games, but I do have a general sense of what they are.
Right.
And all of the stuff you know is in there. I think the basic control scheme is probably the same. You have characters on the field, and you go around, they have different move sets, but in general they have a light attack, heavy attack, and then some specials, and there's enemies all over the place, and you take them out and whatnot. What they've done with this is it really does feel more like Fire Emblem than I expected at all. And I don't know how much of this is stuff that they tweaked from the Musou games and how much of it is stuff they've specifically brought in. But, like, the general format is very Fire Emblem-esque, where it's split into a series of chapters, and each chapter has one, you know, big combat scenario. So it's got that going for it. There is a very strategic element to each match, where the way it's set up is you have a map that you have to look at. You have a number of units on the field who you can pick. And, you know, you put your units in, and you have other ones that are going to be computer-controlled. and you have a number of like bases you have to go seize on the map by killing the fort leader and doing that, and then more missions and scenarios will pop up over the course of the match, which can range from, they give you like a 60-minute time limit in general. Sometimes it's less than that.
Oh, right, yeah.
You don't need that much.
For a second, I thought you said 60-second time limit. I'm like, that sounds crazy. It's like, oh, 60-minute. That sounds very reasonable.
Yes. So, you know, generally, like, these take me at least 15 minutes, sometimes longer. And they start getting really creative in that way I get from really good Fire Emblem game scenarios, where it's like, whatever you have to do to beat this match, either it's really, you know, creative enemy layout, or there's certain objectives you have to hit. There's some really cool things going on. And, like, it's just, it's such an addictive, interesting, like, legitimately challenging gameplay loop where each map, once you really get into the meat of the game, there will be so many things going on the map. You'll probably have four heroes on the field that you can play as and jump around to. Heroes can pair up in the way they can in the Fire Emblem games as well, and then they can have support conversations if you get high enough, which you don't really care about because the writing is terrible, but you can still get the cool, like, you know, matchup abilities and everything. And so you're constantly, at any time, you can, like, let's say you're Lucina and you can hit the directional pad and you'll get to another character. So now you're Frederick or something, wherever he is on the map, and you can start picking up with him. And while you're doing that, you can hit the pause menu and go into the map. And on the map, you can say, all right, Lucina, like, controlled by the computer now, I want you to go take this fort. And Lucina will go start to do that. And you'll have other enemies. And so you'll always be playing as one person. And if you're doing it strategically, you'll have other enemies or other players, like, or other characters you play as going to do other objectives on the map. And then you might switch between them when, like, it's clear you need a little, like, human hand to get through certain scenarios because the AI isn't going to do it all for you.
Yeah.
So all of that is really cool. And when the game gets going fully, some of these scenarios are so smart and interesting. Like I was saying, like, the Fire Emblem Fates it uses a little better. Some of that's in the story. Some of it also is that the whole conceit of Fire Emblem Fates allows them to do a lot of really interesting things with the combat design, where the level after you get through the separate Nor Hoshido parts is Nor and Hoshido have decided to fight now, and you, with the characters you've assembled, like the mains, like, from Nor and Hoshido are fighting, but some of the smaller characters are with you, and you've decided, like, we have to stop these guys fighting so we can talk to them and explain the scenario. So the map is divided into, there's forts on the left side that belong to Nor and forts on the right side that belong to Hoshido, and you have to take these forts, but you have to be careful not to take too many of one side, because then they'll get weak and they'll die, and you don't want the characters to die. So it's really, and constantly, like enemies can come in and take your base, so you have to maybe leave someone there to defend it or send someone to go reclaim it. And there's just a million crazy things going on. And so in addition to just all the cool Musou combat where you're going around slashing enemies, which is really fun, I mean, again, as you said, you either like it or you don't. Right. But if you like it, you know, it's just, it like releases something in the brain and it's cool.
Yeah. It is a tremendously cathartic experience for me.
Yes.
Playing those games.
Oh, it's so great. But there is like a ton of strategy going on, and it becomes like legitimately stressful at points to figure out where you're going to put everyone and how you're going to switch between characters to like do these scenarios as well as you can. And then on top of that, they've added some other little pieces of Fire Emblem strategy. The weapon triangle is in this game.
Okay.
So you've got to think about that while you're fighting. The special abilities can bypass that or do different things with it. As I said, the pair-up abilities. So yeah, I get a lot of the same rush out of this I get out of playing a normal Fire Emblem game, where it activates that kind of type A strategy side of your brain, where you're really thinking about, you know, how to move everything for maximal efficiency. But then you also get to just hack and slash groups of enemies. It's a really interesting combination, and you have that. I think that the characters are all really distinct, and they move in interesting ways. And like, if you know, like Lucina, for instance, it's really fun to play as her because it feels like Lucina, but now she's not a unit on a board. You're really controlling her, and all of the characters I've played so far feel pretty distinct, even if you have like multiple mounted units. Not every like horse character moves the same, or every Pegasus
knight. If you're playing as like a cavalier or a knight, are you like just attached to that horse and can't get off it? Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you're on the horse, and it's like Frederick is, who's the knight, the horse knight from Awakening, is fucking awesome. Like, he'll go around the field and just, you can use your axe attack is like, you just take your axe like you're Sauron in Lord of the Rings and just pick up like 20 enemies and fling them into another group of enemies and stuff like that. And when you get to like your full stride as Frederick and you're riding through enemies, he'll just pick up enemies on the side and start hitting them.
Yeah.
And there's just cool stuff like that. My favorite character to play as so far is Cordelia the Pegasus Knight from Awakening. who is awesome. Like, the Pegasus Knights are really cool throughout the game, but she has a really cool ability. Her heavy attack is she just fucking dive bombs the ground and just sends enemy flying, and then you can hit your Y and do a combo where you pick them up and hit them, and then everyone's special attack is very different. So there's also just a lot of strategy in that the characters feel cool and distinct and individual. And again, if you like Fire Emblem, it's an extra rush because it's like, I know this character and I'm having fun playing as them. So, and again, the other thing I would add to that is the music, which is outstanding. It's a really good soundtrack. A lot of it is new, and the stuff that's reused, they'll take like the battle pieces from Awakening or Fates or Shadow Dragon, and they're not just the same pieces, they've completely re-recorded them, often with electric guitar doing the main melody line, which is just cool.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, if you're a Fire Emblem fan, the story is a letdown. Everything else is actually much better than I was expecting going in.
Yeah, it's interesting because some of that stuff you're talking about, like the strategy layer, that does exist in the Musou games, of like that basic structure of you have to go get the different bases and like defeat the whoever the character is that's like defending the base. That is the basic structure of the Musou games, and you can generally in most of the games send like give orders to different generals to go to different places. But it sounds like maybe they make that a bit more necessary, because generally in a Musou game, the ones that I've played, while you can do that, you just don't really need to very often, and because you're just so powerful. The one thing that does sound interesting to me that I've never seen in another one of these games is being able to switch to other people and play them on the fly in the middle of a match. That's something I've never seen before.
Okay, that's interesting, because it's one of the coolest parts of this game. Is that, and you're constantly kind of thinking that in the back of your head of like, who should I be at this moment? Who needs like the human hand on the wheel the most?
Right.
And it's really fun. It also adds a lot of variety to the matches.
Yeah.
No, it's really cool. And it's interesting to hear what you said just now about that it's the similarities to the Musou series. Because it's a really natural fit for Fire Emblem.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of surprises me it took this long. I understand why Hyrule Warriors was first. Zelda is bigger as a friend Nintendo series, but Zelda doesn't have any of those kind of elements in it.
Right.
You know, I guess it has, you know, swordplay and stuff, but it's not like that kind of hack and slash game.
Yeah. Yeah. Because actually, also now that I think about it, Dynasty Warriors 8 also straight up has a weapon triangle as well.
Okay, so, nice.
Like, it's formatted slightly differently because it's about, like, each weapon has an attribute that's, like, heaven, earth, or man. So it's not, like, sword beats spear, blah, 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 whatever. The other way around. But, like, yeah. But it does have that triangle setup as well. Mm-hmm. So it is a more natural fit, maybe, than one would think at first blush.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, some of the main stuff you'll be seeing of, like, for some reason, there's like 1,000 forces on the field for you to go burst your way through. Fire Emblem characters are not superhuman.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you
yeah.
know, it's for fun. Like, Dynasty Warriors comes from this, you know, big Chinese mythology. Obviously,
yeah.
We've talked about that before. So it's not like the most natural fit, but it's a fun, silly spinoff, which is part of why I don't get why the story doesn't just cut loose a little more with it.
Sure.
It's a little weird to me in that direction. Like, I will say this makes me super curious to play Hyrule Warriors, because I've never played it. But I would love to go back and give that game a try and see what it did with Zelda in this. Because
yeah.
I've always heard good things about Hyrule Warriors.
Yeah, me too.
So, and it is on 3DS. I could get that one.
Technically,
I could play that easier than the Wii U. I think the disc is out of print and would be expensive to find.
Sure,
so,
yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a really good game. And there's also stuff you can do, like, on the, you know, between matches. You can go into your inventory, and there's lots of stuff with weapons. And some of it's straight up from Fire Emblem. Some of it, I assume, is more of a Musou kind of thing. I think the menus are a little cumbersome at times in between matches.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of game. Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, like, thinking about the story stuff, because in Dynasty, when I was playing through Dynasty Warriors 8 Extreme Legends, like, I actually very much enjoyed the story of that game. Which is not to say that it was good, but there's something about the utter absurdity of doing this really ridiculous, like, anime style, like, over the top character, like, recreation of, like, memorable and, like, pivotal scenes from one of, like, the greatest works of world literature ever, Romance of the Three Kingdoms, that was big, like, you know, it's a book that's, like, 500 years old, and recreating that in this, like, absurd sensibility. There's something about that, the sheer audacity of that, I love so much. That seeing that, like, because I imagine probably the storytelling style from kind of like what you're telling me is probably fairly similar between the Dynasty Warriors stuff and this Fire Emblem Warriors game.
Yeah.
So I could understand that in that format, it just like wouldn't hold any water. But it was like, but it would be like if you played a video game version of Hamlet that told the story that way. You're like, this is just the delta between the source, the storytelling and the source material, and what you're showing me here is so extreme and so wide. It's this like a Grand Canyon quality gap between these two things that like somehow like counterintuitively actually makes it really amazing and entertaining.
And I think you can do that. Like, you could, I think, do that with Hamlet easier than you could Fire Emblem.
Yeah, because Fire Emblem, while it's, like, a great video game series, is not one of, like, the most significant contributions to, like, culture in the history of the species.
It does not have that general gravity.
Yeah.
And I also don't think this game sort of takes the right tone with the gravity it does have. But, you know, end of the day, it's a story that does get you from point A to point B.
Right.
The gameplay is the star here. I don't, you know, we have enough good video game stories out this year. We had a good Fire Emblem game earlier this year. Fuck it. I'll take it, you know?
Right.
It's like, it's fine. And you know what? It allows me to, between the gameplay and we have the cutscenes, I just pull out my phone and do stuff and I listen to it, like, with half my attention, if that.
Sure.
And it's fine. Whatever. You know, games can be that sometimes. I don't particularly care. The one thing I will say in terms of what the story does in giving things stakes, where I do think it falls down a bit, is, at least where I am now, every fight is still Fire Emblem characters have a misunderstanding and go to all-out war, which is, you know, amplified by the craziness of the Dynasty Warriors combat. And it's just, it does get a little tiresome of like, just shut up and talk! This is insane! Like, this would be like if the Avengers was, they just fought for 2.5 hours and then at the last 5 minutes fought Loki. Right. Like, there's a balance. You do want your, like, characters to fight before they team up. That's an old trope. But they have to, like, work towards something greater at some point. And so far we haven't gotten to that.
Yeah. It's like just at some point, it's like Lucina or whoever like falls on their knees. It's like, I literally just murdered 4,000 people. And you're telling me that this was all some silly misunderstanding?
Yeah.
Like, I'm never going to be able to sleep again. I'm never going to be able to get the blood off my fucking armor from what I just did.
Like
I just committed the most single amazing feat of mass murder in the history of the fucking world.
It's
over nothing.
It is like you'll have these really great matches that are so creative in how they've laid everything out on the map, and they look so cool, and the objectives are so, you know, challenging and interesting, and it's stressful, but in a good way. And then you'll remember, right, it's because, you know, this character's sister, who's hanging out with us, thought we had kidnapped her sister and won't listen, and now she's fighting us and somehow erected a whole base in the process. Even though she's from a different world.
Yeah. It's like, and they will never stop digging the graves in the from this battle, right? It's like the discrepancy between like the cartoon action and the ridiculous story and like thinking about that in real world terms is very silly.
Yeah. But again, it's fun. Talking about it on the Nintendo Switch itself, it's an interesting game technically because they have this mode for TV mode where you can pick either what's called quality or performance mode. Quality mode is 1080p locked 30fps. And that's primarily how I've played it, and I will say, you know, for a game that is obviously very taxing technically in terms of how much is going on screen at any time, that 30fps is rock solid.
Okay,
there are moments where it'll get a little lighter, but, like, it's generally, I'm impressed that, like, that crazy finishing move didn't fuck with the frame rate. And it's not the most graphically impressive game in the world, but, you know, this kind of game can't be. They can't have, like, uncharted textures, you know, going on.
Yeah.
But I do think it looks very nice. It has a good aesthetic. I think that the 3D environments look good and have a very good Fire Emblem aesthetic to them. And then if you play it on the handheld mode, it's 720p 30, and it looks pretty much the same, and it plays great there, too. I've played several of the matches handheld. That's actually how I started the game. And so it looks great either way. But they also have this performance mode, which drops the resolution to 720p on the TV and unlocks the frame rate. And so it can theoretically go to 60fps. It will not always hit that, though. It's a more inconsistent frame rate. I tried that a little bit. Normally, I prefer frame rate, but it just, like, the textures got too muddy. The resolution drop, which, again, normally I don't care about, got very fuzzy. And it kind of looked like you were playing, like, an earlier, like, alpha version of the game, especially because the frame rate kind of goes up and down and everything. It's cool that it's there, though. I mean, especially, like, the Nintendo Switch, like, most console games don't do anything like that. And the Nintendo Switch is not, like, at the front of the field technically. So it's a cool thing. You can only do it on TV mode, but it is a neat feature that they have in there. I have kept it in quality mode because that also means that, like, it looks roughly the same between the tablet and the TV. But it plays great either way. Like, this is a game that works totally fine on the Joy-Cons. It's not like there's too complex controls or anything.
Right,
or
it's like a lot of, like, square, 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 triangle, square, square, triangle, circle.
Right.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's pretty good handheld because there are a couple of matches where, like, I finished them, but I haven't gotten all the objectives I've wanted, so I want to do something else, and I'll just, like, pull it out and like played in a different room doing that while listening to a podcast or something. Yeah. So it's cool. It's definitely it's a really cool title to have on the Switch. Another very different kind of game for the catalog. So
cool. Well, speaking of games that
I can give you a second. I had one more thing to say. Sorry.
You just wrapped it all up.
Sorry.
You're ruining my perfect segue.
I just want to say my PS on it is also that I did get the special edition.
Oh, right.
And I wanted to talk about it really quick.
Okay, yeah.
Because we've had a lot of cool special editions this year. This one is actually really worthwhile because it's $20 more. But one of the things you get is the full soundtrack. It's three discs. It looks like just something you would buy from Japan for $60 or something. It's just the full soundtrack. And before I got the game, I didn't know if that would be a good deal because a lot of them are tracks that are theoretically from other games. But again, they're all re-recorded. They're new versions of them. So you just get the full soundtrack, which again is probably more than a $20 value knowing how much these go for generally.
Right.
So that's really cool. I really liked having that. And, Sean, Lindis is on disc three. She gets the character portrait on disc three.
Okay, there you go.
Which is very neat. You also get you get a poster that you can fold out, and one side is in English, one side is in Japanese, and it shows which games all the characters are from, and that's kind of fun. And like the Japanese side has the original like Famicom art and things like that, so that's kind of neat. And even chronologically orders the games because they came out in a different order, U.S. versus Japan, so that's neat. And then the weirdest, like this is one of the weirdest things I've ever gotten in a special edition, and you guys know I have a weird affinity for video game special editions.
Yeah. Maybe an unhealthy affinity at some point.
My wallet would say that, yes.
Yeah.
You know, like Super Mario Odyssey is coming out next week, and it doesn't have a special edition, so I compensated by pre-ordering three Amiibo. They're the cool wedding ones. Come on.
I don't care if the cool wedding ones. They're still Amiibo.
It's the dark side.
It's the fucking, like, Nintendo's weird version of microtransactions that you bought into.
You get something for it.
I thought we weren't talking about video games with microtransactions in this section of the podcast.
But the weird thing it has is this, and it makes the special edition like a really thick box. Is you play it, it looks like this big hardcover book with like the logo and everything on it. You open it, and it's got like it's a box with 20 character cards, like a card or more than that, a card for every playable character in the game. Lindis is one of them. She's the second card included.
Yeah, she should be the first, though.
The first is Anna, just because she narrates the game.
Also, like, the story of the game should just be you play as Lindis, and she just, like, has to go kill every other Fire Emblem character because none of them are good enough. It's just like, I'm the best character in this whole franchise. None of you are worthy to even be in this game. So she kills them so they can't even be in the crossover game.
Okay, anyway. But yeah, and they're, like, these really thick character cards that have kind of nice art on them. But it's like a really big physical thing. Like, you know, it's probably like yay thick, like, you know, a couple inches or something. Not a couple inches, but like an inch thick.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got these big character cards. And so it's this really nice physical thing. I'm not really sure what to do with it other than look at the cards sometimes. But normally that kind of thing would be like this little packet you'd get in the thing. They like went all out with it. It's like, it's, you know, bigger than the game box and stuff like that. So
I can tell you what to do with one of those cards. You can put the Lindis one in your wallet and keep her with you forever.
I mean, the card is like the size of a DVD.
You just get a bigger wallet.
Okay. Yes. No. But it is kind of an interesting collectible. I think it's worth it for the soundtrack. If you're going to get the game, I'd recommend the special edition just because you do get some very cool stuff that if you value soundtracks and stuff, which I know not everyone is as into as I am, I do like getting these soundtracks. Because this is knowing Japanese games, that soundtrack will never be issued anywhere else.
Right, yeah. And like you said, it's something that if you're interested in getting the soundtrack, it's a like you're like it's a good deal. Like
yes.
You're paying that money for actually something that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I always feel that like if you're going to do a special edition of a video game, you should put the soundtrack in it. Because that is the biggest incentive for me.
Nintendo's also done stuff with their special editions this year where the actual game box that you get, which is a standard Switch box, but it has different back cover art and some different stuff inside. So that kind of looks... They did that on Metroid and they did that on The Legend of Zelda and some other ones. So anyway, it's a cool special edition. I liked it. And, you know, I don't think this game is like so in demand that it's impossible to get.
Yeah.
Probably.
I think people can get their hands on it.
But, and you should. It's a good game. Speaking of which.
So, anyways, going back to before you rudely interrupted me. Speaking of Koei Tecmo developed video games that have one mode that has a higher resolution but a lower frame rate and one mode that has a higher frame rate but a lower resolution, I've been playing Nioh.
Wow, what a transition!
It was a great fucking segue that would have worked great if you hadn't shot in the head.
I'm sorry, Sean.
Anyways, yes, I have been playing also a Koei Tecmo game that has that weird, very specific thing to it that I think is really cool. For Nioh, I have been playing in the lower resolution, higher frame rate mode, because you need all the fucking frames you're going to get to be able to survive this game, because it is fucking really hard, and it relies on incredibly precise timing. And if you play on that, on the higher frame rate mode, it is a solid 60 frames per second, basically constantly, which is very good, because again, it is very necessary. So I'm going to, like this is a game we've talked about a little bit on the podcast here and there when we were playing like the betas and stuff when those came out. But I'm going to like start sort of fresh for this discussion, just because there might be people listening that weren't listening to those podcasts or don't even remember what Neo was, because it's not a game that has... I think the game has sold fine, but it didn't get the biggest publicity in the world. So it came out in February, and it is a sort of Dark Souls-inspired game, though I think people maybe make a bit too much of that connection, because they are... Neo and Dark Souls are very different. But it is this Team Ninja-developed game that is sort of vaguely inspired by Dark Souls, mostly in terms of the way the combat uses stamina mechanics, and the very intense difficulty is what it kind of really brought from Dark Souls, and a little bit of the level design philosophy. But it is set in Sengoku-era Japan. It is set specifically in the year 1600, and you're playing as William Adams, who was an actual... British dude from, you know, the 17th century and late 16th century, who in a voyage went to Japan and was basically shipwrecked in Japan and hooked up with Tokugawa Ieyasu, who eventually became the shogun who united all of Japan after the Sengoku era. And ruled, like, his family and his clan basically ruled Japan through military authority for like 200 years until the mid-19th century. And so that's kind of where it takes place in history. And this William Adams guy, again, was a real person. He, you know, learned how to speak Japanese and like basically lived out the rest of his life, like 20 to 30 years in Japan, like known as Miura Anjin, which is also what your character is known as in this game, and was like a right-hand advisor to Tokugawa Ieyasu.
That's kind of an awesome story. Yeah, why have I not heard that before?
Like, I had never heard about it before either, and like when I was kind of playing the game, I started researching it, and then ended up spending like 3 hours just reading up stuff about it online, because I was so fascinated by the idea. It is, if people are familiar with the James Clavell novel Shogun and the associated TV show, that is loosely based also on William Adams' life.
It sounds like a less sad version of the Martin Scorsese movie Silence.
Sure, yes.
Where people get stuck in Japan but don't want to be there.
Yeah. This is sort of a different scenario. But because he recreated this whole new life for himself in Japan and like rose up to be like the super high, like in the Tokugawa dynasty. Again, like he was like Ieyasu's right hand dude for anything related to foreigners, which was a big issue in the early Tokugawa dynasty, because that's when they sort of settled on all these policies of closing off the borders of Japan and stuff like that. So obviously the events of this game are like not this like one-to-one exact historical recreation by any stretch of the imagination, but it is loosely inspired on this actual history and this actual historical figure. But they do make one really important upgrade to William Adams in how he's presented in this game, is that the real life William Adams was a British, like English ass fucking English dude. In this game, he is a fucking Irish ass Irish dude, and it is fucking awesome. It is really good.
Wow, Sean, this game is so for you. It combines your love of Japanese culture with your proud Irish heritage.
Yes.
This is for you, Sean.
My love of fucking cutting up demons with swords. It's everything I love in one thing. All it needs is like Doctor Who to sort of just like materialize in the middle of it. And it's like, I'm golden. Like, you've done everything. Like, this is the game I'll play for the rest of my life. But yeah, so the game... the thing to talk about with this game more than the story stuff is the gameplay. It is this very just, it's unbelievably exceptional action-based game that has a intense amount of complexity to it. Basically, you can have two different weapons at any given time, and you have a pretty in-depth skill tree that you are leveling up, so you kind of really want to focus on two weapons. I'm using the, like, single katana and the spear. I think there are, if you get the DLC, there's ultimately 7 weapons in total, and they all have a really intricate move list that you are upgrading constantly as you go through the game and getting more and more complicated moves. Each weapon also has associated with it 3 different stances, a high stance, a mid stance, and a low stance that all have different advantages. Generally, the high stance is slow attacks, high damage. Mid stance is like defense based with a lot of counter moves. And the low stance is lower damage but higher attack speed and like better dodges. And that's generally true across all the different weapon types, but there are a lot of nuances between different weapons about like different move sets that are available to specific stances and stuff like that. And it is just like there's It's rare for a video game, a combat system in a video game to be as satisfying to me as Neo's is. And just, I feel like I have been playing this game, I've probably put like 15 to 20 hours somewhere in there into this game. And it's not even counting the time I already put out into the alpha and beta. And I feel like every time I play this game, I'm getting better and better and better at the combat, which is so rare. Like, it's so rare to have a game that's like, you don't hit this sort of like basic ceiling the first 5 to 6 hours in when you've like kind of mastered all the basic mechanics, and you're going to get a little bit better, obviously. And like, you know, when you encounter a new enemy type, you're going to have to like relearn a couple of things and reapply them. But generally speaking, most games, like if I'm thinking about most of the games I played this year, like Zelda or Horizon Zero Dawn or like Gravity Rush 2 or whatever, like, or Persona 5, like, you are definitely getting better at the combat system as you're playing the game, but you definitely hit this point where you're like, okay, I've mastered the basics of this, and each sort of like bit I learn and a little like better I get at the combat system is really just sort of like diminishing returns towards this like sort of like fairly easy to access, pretty high level of gameplay that's going to get you through everything you need to do relatively easy. You know, like think about like the combat in Uncharted Lost Legacy. It's good, it's fun, it's fine, but it's not something that you feel like I am mastering and like I'm like mastering the skill. In Neo, it really does feel like every single time I'm playing the game, I encounter some scenario where I'm like, oh shit, if I use like this move with the low stance with the katana against this specific enemy type, I will have this much stamina left to then like approach this other scenario. And I'm constantly sort of encountering scenarios in the game where my strategies I've already developed are being challenged, and I have to back off and rethink them. And every time that happens, I sort of learn something even deeper about like, okay, so I can use this, you know, quick draw attack with the katana in this way to close the distance gap against this enemy, or like this kind of enemy, I need to make sure I'm rolling away from this kind of attack. And that's now making me think of, okay, if I attack now when I fight these demons, like this Yoki enemy that has a similar kind of attack, me finding this other enemy has made me realize, oh, this is a better strategy for those. And I'm constantly reassessing the strategies and techniques I have for fighting the different enemy types in the game and expanding my moveset to get better and better and better at the game, because the game is constantly challenging me to get better, because if I don't, I can't proceed, because it is that level of difficult. So like just last night, I was stuck on this one fight on a bridge where there was one enemy who had a lot of health, and once you got his health halfway down, two additional these like really annoying skull motherfuckers just pop up that kind of shoot projectiles at you. And I was having the hardest time defeating this guy, because most of the time when I'm fighting human based enemies in the game, my main strategy has been to try to find a way to get their stamina lower than mine and push their stamina into this sort of breaking point state where you then like can do this kind of execution type move on them and do a lot of damage. Because one of the key features of the combat is that you have your stamina that dictates how much attacks you can do, but so do all the enemies in the game. And the human enemies in particular have the same kind of stamina you do, and every attack they make, every roll they do, takes down from their stamina thing, and they're going to have to recharge that, or they're at risk of if you keep on hammering on their defenses, they're going to run out of stamina, which is something that's really a key difference between Dark Souls, which doesn't have that at all. Like, enemies don't even have stamina. In this, they have stamina, and you are directly exposed to how much they have, so you can use that directly in your strategies. But this enemy I was fighting had stamina that, like, there was just no way I was wearing it all the way down, and it was really sort of making it hard for me to figure out, okay, what am I doing to get this guy? And then eventually I got this into this rhythm where I realized, okay, this specific counterattack I have... that is a block with a katana and you use square is a really fast counterattack that I can do in quick succession compared to the higher damage one that uses the triangle counter that I was normally using, because it's like, why would I ever use this other counterattack that follows up with a weaker attack? I want to do the one that does the most damage. But if you're doing it against an enemy that has all this stamina, you need to keep on taking their attacks and countering them very, very quickly. And there's too much lead up time and like lead down time from that triangle counter to do that. So this whole move that I had in my arsenal since like the first 3 hours of the game that I'd almost never used, and having to sort of reassess how to tackle this fight, I was like, okay, this is how you do this. I've almost never used this move. I had totally dismissed this entire attack as useless. And it is totally vital for how I'm clearing this fight. But I know I'm only using two of the weapon types available in the game. Like, if you don't have the katana, you don't even have that attack. So, like, presumably there's something, if you're using the fucking axe, if you're using the Kusari Dagama, if you're using the dual swords, the tanfas, like the giant sword, all of those different, or like if you're using the spear, because I didn't even like think about using the spear on him, all those different moves and all those different like weapon sets and move sets probably have a number of different like strategies that would have been really effective against that enemy that I don't even know about. And the deeper and deeper I get into the game, the more and more of those layers are being exposed to me. And it is remarkably satisfying to play in that way. And it's just, it's so fun to play a game where I feel like I am developing the skill of playing the game instead of just sort of like playing it through for the story. It is this really like intensive systems-based gameplay first kind of game that like even more than a Dark Souls or Demon's Souls or Bloodborne, the combat is so complicated. There are so many different facets to it. And you really have to make use of those different facets. These are not fights that you can just cheese in the way you can cheese most Dark Souls fights. If you're pushed to that point, you can't just sort of like, you know, like arrow spam your way through these kinds of fights because they'll just block it. You can't do that kind of stuff.
I'm really interested in all of this because like, this is another game that sounds like terrifyingly complex to me.
Sure.
But I totally understand why you love it because this is one of my questions was going to be, when you first talked about Dark Souls on this podcast like 4 or 5 years ago in the apartment in Boulder and you played it for the first time, back when we had a 360 set up on the TV.
Right, yeah.
Right? And you kind of fell in love with this thing. Would you have expected, A, that it would become this really dominant subgenre in gaming and inspire all these other things, and that you would play at least one game that was kind of like this a year and like love it more seemingly each time?
Yeah, like part of me like kind of yes and kind of no. I think like the thing I don't know if I ever expected like that the Dark Souls specific kind of game to push outside of that developer From Software, but I think it does feel natural to me, particularly like Team Ninja, who people might probably most know for either Dead or Alive, or for me it's the Ninja Gaiden reboots, and because I played the fucking Ninja Gaiden Black on the original Xbox, I played that game so many times, and it has a very similar, in a weird way, it has a similar kind of approach to difficulty and responsiveness of combat. But in that year, it was much more of that sort of like, you know, 3D character action game that's all about like these long combo attacks and very complicated combo chains, and less about the like really deliberate kind of combat that the Dark Souls and the Neo kind of game has. But it does feel like a natural evolution of that 3D character action game. That obviously, sometimes you get like Bayonetta 2 or something like that that does feel like those. But mostly those games felt like they kind of petered out over the course of the PS2 and PS3 generation. And this is a lot of the sort of same philosophy to difficulty and the same like sort of basic like character movement stuff, but it does take this much more sort of brutal and calculating approach to combat that makes you sort of, you can't just like hit the attack button over and over and over and over and over and over and over again and kind of spam your way through a fight, because you have this really important concept of the stamina meter that once that stamina meter depletes, you're fucked. You can't block, you can't roll, you can't attack, you're just done. And that resource management skill is kind of what makes that combat system.
It's interesting to me because I'm very much an outsider on these games. Like, right. I have tried Dark Souls. I tried Bloodborne. I just don't think they're for me. But, like, I you know, you look at 5 minutes of Bloodborne, you're like, I get why people think this is cool. This is a really interesting atmosphere mixed with all this stuff. And I've played some of Neo as well. I played the beta, I think. They had a lot of rounds of that.
I think it was the beta. Because you played the one where you can fight the vampire lady, right?
Yeah,
and that's the end of the second level? Yeah.
Yeah, so... but it is interesting for me to trace this that, you know, as you say, this is like eking out from just From Software, and now it feels like this is a larger kind of movement that's kind of like taking inspiration from different areas and iterating on itself. I find that really interesting because this kind of thing that in the cultural video game zeitgeist started as kind of just related to this like one game, the Demon's Souls series.
Yeah.
It's interesting how that's becoming more of a thing. And as you say, Neo is very different than that, but I think it's part of what's fascinating to me on the outside looking in.
I mean, Neo for me just feels like it has sort of cemented that this is just a new subgenre of game. Like, full out, like Neo changes a lot of very important things about it, but it is very like clearly direct. And I mean, they've said this in interviews that like, Team Ninja was heavily inspired by Dark Souls in a lot of like the structural ways that they approach the game.
It's just fascinating because like Dark Souls came in relatively late in the 360 generation, and now it's like it's become one of the weirdly dominant subgenres of this generation of gaming. It's one of the weirder, more unexpected stories.
Absolutely.
That you can have like at least one major release in that subgenre a year.
Yeah, and one of the great things about Neo is that like, I really enjoyed Dark Souls 3 a lot. I think it was, like, my number 4 game of the year last year. But it did feel tired by the end. By the end of it, I was like, okay, you can't make another Dark Souls game. Maybe 5-7 years from now, you know, this team can come back and make another Dark Souls game. But, like, this specific version of this is really done. And Neo just does so much to change a lot of like the fundamental nature of the combat and the structure of the game to make it feel incredibly fresh. One of the things I really love about Neo, thinking about like specifically directly comparing it to Dark Souls, is that in Dark Souls and like those sort of like Demon Souls, Dark Souls, and Bloodborne, those kinds of games, it was like when you were leveling up your character, it got to this point that you had to be like very exacting in how you're leveling up your character. There's a lot of like the community like sort of like came up with all this stuff like, oh, you have like a soft cap on like your dexterity or strength stat that is going to like once you hit like level 40 dexterity, any more points you put into that, you're still going to get more damage out of this like, you know, katana or dex-based weapon, but it's going to be like less and less the more points you put in. And so the community quickly came up with means of that you can sort of min-max and maximize your character build. And it felt like the Dark Souls games were really kind of designed for you to do that. That you were really meant to pick one weapon that you're like, I like this weapon. I like its like moveset. I'm going to stick with this thing. And you upgrade that weapon. You upgrade the stat that is associated with the damage for that weapon. You upgrade your life. You upgrade your dexterity. And then maybe you can kind of upgrade one more stat along with that. That would dictate like a magic thing that you could. If I want to do pyromancy, I'm going to get this. If I want to do like, you know, cleric-based magic, I'm going to get faith or whatever. Neo has a really different approach that it feels like you are meant to have a much more balanced character build because every single stat benefits you in some way. And that's one thing I really love is that you have some of the similar sort of like magic abilities in Dark Souls. There's a similar concept in Neo that's Onmyo magic, which is Onmyo Jutsu, which is like sort of traditional Japanese sort of like mythology magic. And then you also have Ninjutsu, which gives you all these different abilities and like shuriken and that kind of stuff. But instead of it being like, oh, if I want to be able to use the magic abilities to any reasonable level of effectiveness, I have to just like only put in like stats into that ability. Instead, it's like, no, like these are abilities that are well round out your character and give you more tools to approach more situations. And the game feels like it is fully expecting you to make use of that and to have this more well-rounded character that like you're upgrading some of your life. You're upgrading some of your stamina. You're upgrading whatever your stat is that is associated with a specific weapon type that is going to specifically increase the damage for that kind of weapon. But all those other stats also do things like increase the amount of like the weight limit on the armor you're carrying. They do things like increase the amount of damage that your ranged weapon is going to do. That you have like a bow or a rifle that you can also take with you. Again, like also some of them increase like what your ninjutsu powers are and stuff like that, or increase the ability of your living weapon spirit thing that is like the super attack you can do. And so all the stats do multiple things, so no matter what kind of character you're playing as, you are benefited from leveling up all those stats, which is to me a more satisfying way to play the game, because it's less about having this like a crazy number of different range of character builds, which is one of the things people do like about Dark Souls 1 and 2 in particular. But for me, since I'm someone who basically I'm going to play through this game once, or like if I do play through it again, I'm probably kind of going to use a similar character build because that's the way I like to play these games. It's really satisfying to me to be able to have access to those other abilities instead of just being like, well, maybe one day in the future I can spend another 60 hours playing Dark Souls 1 and then I can find out what the fuck sorceries are all about. But right now, unless I waste a bunch of souls and experience dumping points into this stat that I'm only ever going to use for sorceries, I'm never going to know if that's something I want to use. Whereas in Neo, I know that I want to use Onmyo magic because it lets me, like, I have a talisman that lets me, like, slowly recover my health. I have one that gives, like, lightning damage on my fucking sword. I have a ninjutsu thing that makes me sprint really fast for short periods of time. Like, all these things that are not like, this is the only way I'm damaging things is by using my ninjutsu. But they're all things that supplement sort of, like, more well-designed sort of mainstream combat ways of approaching these games. Which was always the thing in Dark Souls, I never wanted to do magic guy because the main mechanics of these games of like stamina and combat and rolling are all designed around you using a melee weapon. And the idea of playing through those games, mostly not using melee weapons, just has always seemed incredibly boring to me. So I think Neo has, I just like the way that they set up their level stuff too. Another key difference from Dark Souls, and this is another thing I really like, is the top level structure of the game is completely different from the Dark Souls series, where the Dark Souls series had two different main ways to sort of design the overall structure of the game. It was either a like totally seamless world that you just moved from one area to the next area, like almost pseudo open world way style, but like the areas were more linearly designed, so it's not like Grand Theft Auto or something. But it was like you start at Firelink Shrine and you can just from like any point in the game, you can seamlessly walk to any other point of the game. It's just some of them are going to take you a while to get to, but you can go to any of them without encountering loading screens. that's sort of like the Dark Souls 1 way to do it. Or some of the other Dark Souls games have like a almost Mega Man-esque like hub world that you go to, and then from that hub world you teleport out to the different sort of spokes of the game that are interconnected levels.
That should totally be how they reboot Mega Man.
Yes.
Mega Man Dark Souls.
Yes, Mega Man Dark Souls. I mean, you know, the Mega Man games maybe have, there's some DNA in there. Yes. They're like really brutal games that have like a combat focus that, you know, you go and you, they're also focused on boss fights. So there's a similarity there.
Well, in this one, Mega Man vomits blood when he gets hit too hard.
Exactly, yes. And he's fighting like unknowable, horrific, demonic aberrations instead of like robot masters. Yeah, but anyways, the way that Neo is structured from the top level is you have a map screen that you go to, and from that map screen you select missions. And so you have basically, I would say, like there are kind of four different kinds of missions. There's the main mission where you have like big, long maps that are kind of like how you think of a Dark Souls level. That's very long. You go through a number of different areas. It's probably going to take you an hour to 3 hours, depending on how long you, how much you die, how much you explore, to go through this. And at the end, you have like a really challenging boss you have to fight. And that's like the core meat of the game. Then there are side missions that are set in those big levels that once you complete them, you can go back in, and they have restructured and sort of like siloed off specific sort of a lot of the side areas of the levels they will use, and put different enemies in different places and kind of like totally rebuild the experience of moving through that level. But they will reuse sections of that geometry to do a smaller side mission that will probably be like 30 minutes long. And then there are some side missions, like the one I was talking about on the bridge, that are just like, this is a very small map that is custom made for this one side mission that's literally just like this one, like sort of like walkway up to a bridge, and then it's just this bridge, and that's the whole level, and it's just this one fight. And that's a side mission that, like, if you beat that fight, you could clear that side mission in 2 minutes. Or, like me, it could take you an hour of being like, oh, fuck, okay, that didn't work. Tried this guy. Then, like, eventually I, like, died so many times to that guy, I left and did another side mission and came back fresh and did it better. But that structure I really love, of being able to go in and say, like, okay, I want to do the main mission and sort of progress the story. And, do like, I have a lot of time where I can sit down and just go through this whole thing. Or as like has become more and more frequent for me, I don't have 3 hours to just sit down and play this game because I want to try to do those big runs in one big sitting, because, you know, you need to really get into the flow of it to be good at the game. But sometimes I'm sitting down, it's like, I have 30 minutes to an hour to play this. I don't want to do one of the big main missions. And so instead I can just knock out a bunch of these side missions and still feel like I'm progressing in the game. I'm getting loot because there's also a lot of loot in the game. I'm leveling my guy up. I'm getting all this different stuff. And I'm, you know, I can pick up these different upgrades along the way and get my skill tree advanced more and more, but I don't have to dedicate this huge amount of time, because if you're playing a Dark Souls style game, like those are like 60 hour long games that demand really long play sessions, because if you're not getting into the flow of a Dark Souls level, you're not going to be able to, like, you know, you can't leave in the middle of a Dark Souls level and come back 2 days later. You have no idea what you're doing, no idea where you're trying to go, no idea how to fight these enemies anymore. You're going to be, like, too far away from it. You have to be so in the moment. And Neo just feels like it's, that superstructure is so much better supportable of, like, a very different ways of approaching and playing the game that is, accommodates the player better, which I really appreciate. Because I think it would be very hard for me right now if, like, Dark Souls 3 had come out, like, right now. I don't think I'd be able to play that game. But I can play Neo pretty comfortably. And that's a smart way, I think, to design the game.
Nice.
Yes. So that's all the gameplay stuff. To finish up this conversation, I want to go back and talk about the story stuff very quickly. Because while the story is not very good, necessarily, like, it's not this, you know, like, deep character drama with all these themes, it is very fun and very goofy, and particularly if you know anything about the sort of historical era it takes place in, it's really interesting to just go through and basically what happens is you land in, like, the southern tip of the main island of Japan, and you are working your way up, and, like, I assume you're basically going to, I think actually the last piece of DLC literally takes place in Hokkaido. So it's like you're just going north up Japan, meeting all these different warlords from this really interesting period of Japanese history, which is this sort of liminal space where the Sengoku era of these warring states has mostly died down. Oda Nobunaga has been dead for a while. Who he's one of the main sort of like big generals who's trying to unify Japan, and he has been killed. And then his immediate successor, I always forget this dude's name, but his right-hand man who took over from him, he has also died. And so now Tokugawa Ieyasu is the next up in the sort of lineage of main generals that were following Nobunaga. And eventually he's going to succeed. And most of the other enemies that are going to like to impede him are fairly weakened. And there's, you know, he's in a really good position, but he's not quite there yet. So it's at this really interesting tipping point in Japanese history. And so you're meeting all these different figures as you're going up the way to like sort of, and I have just gotten to the halfway point where I've made it to Osaka, and I have not met Tokugawa Ieyasu. I have met his Kagemusha. I've met his body double first, which is fun. But the thing that is really, really fascinating to me about it is the role of William, because if you could be forgiven if you thought that this game was made by a Western developer to be like, oh, fucking, like, Last Samurai, like, what the fuck, white dude, like, is the samurai, like, all those tropes. But obviously this is not. This is Team Ninja from Koei Tecmo. This is a Shibusawa co-production. Like, this is a Japanese-ass fucking Japanese video game. And there's something so fascinating to me about you start this fucking video game in the prologue chained up in the Tower of London. And the first level of this game is you are going through escaping from the Tower of London where you have been imprisoned, and you encounter Edward Kelly, who is the main villain in the game, who's an actual historical figure, who is like a apprentice of John Dee, who was a famous like 16th century mysticist dude in England. And so Edward Kelly is this ridiculous villain who is using like this sorcerer dude who's trying to use magic to capture Amarita, which is basically this game's version of souls. It's the thing you get used to level up, and he's creating monsters and demons out of it. And he steals Cersei, which is your guardian spirit, which is like this Irish mythological figure. And it, one of the core conceits of this game is that William Adams, Irish pirate, has the ability to see spirits and like see like magical spirits basically. And he can commune with them, and he has this guardian spirit, Circe, that the villain steals from him, and then is going to go to Japan because Japan has all these spirits. Because it's a very Shinto kind of like, you know, every rock has a god kind of thing. So William Adams follows him to Japan. That's where you get that like first level from the alpha and slash the beta that ends with you fighting the giant demon in the boat. That is like the first real level of the game, also in the full game. But the progression from there of you have landed in Japan, also on the boat ride over, which also like they actually take from history, there were like four boats that William Adams, like in this fleet that William Adams was in, and three of them all sank. And then like the last one kind of half crashed when it got to Japan. And so he like gets there. On the boat ride over, he has a book that he reads that is from someone who had visited Japan that tells him all about all the weapons and armor from Japan. And that's how this dude knows how to use swords and like katana and like Japanese spears and all this shit. And it's such a great line of where it just says like, I feel like I have some sort of unexplainable affinity with the descriptions written in this book. As if I have used these weapons all my life. And I love that fucking explanation for how this like white dude is able to use all these Japanese swords. And then once you get to Japan and you beat that first mission, you meet Hattori Hanzo, who's like this, right, you know, historical ninja dude. One, Hattori Hanzo, in this game, he tells the time by pulling a cat out of his like his outfit and looking at the cat's eyes and telling by how dilated the cat's eyes are, that's what the time is. That's a fucking awesome fucking thing that comes the fuck out of nowhere. It's really amazing. But that's also a sequence where, this is something I knew from the beta, because this cutscene was in the beta, but it plays out in more detail here, and it's one of my favorite things about the story of this game that I really think helps set the mood and attitude, because it is the tone and atmosphere of the story, more than the actual events of the story, that are really interesting to me, is that William Adams speaks English in this like super Irish accent, and all the Japanese people speak Japanese, and they're, you know, like from, like, I could name half of the Japanese voice actors in this game, because they're all just pulled from the main Japanese voice acting industry. But Hattori Hanzo speaks English, and it's like the Japanese voice actor speaking in like reasonable enough English, but clearly like that's not his first language, and like clearly like not even like it's not something he's like super well trained in. It's kind of this broken Japanese English, but it's a natural performance from that actor. And there's one other character that's also another ninja that you meet that also can speak English to you in that way, and that is so fascinating to me that you have that's how that game handles language. That it's like there's no English dub because your main character and Edward Kelly, the main villain, both just speak English and are just English-speaking voice actors, and all the Japanese characters speak Japanese, and they all, like, call you Anjin Dono, and, you know, they... Eventually, there's sort of this explanation of you talk to this one cat spirit who says, like, oh, basically, I'm going to translate this stuff for you in your head because I'm kind of, like, possessing you and haunting you, so that's how you can that's how William Adams can understand what people are saying to him, but he can't speak to them in any way. And there have been a number of really interesting cutscenes that play off of this idea of William being a foreigner in these lands, but it's from the perspective of that culture instead of from the perspective of our culture looking at them. It's their culture looking at us. And I think that is a really fascinating tone that makes you feel like such an outsider playing this game as this character and having to sort of like make your way through Japan and meet all these interesting historical figures and deal with the mythology of Japan as the mythology of Japan is like literally coming to life and trying to kill you because all the monsters are pulled from, you know, Japanese monsters from mythology. And so I think that's something that I think you'd be very easily forgiven for sort of totally dismissing that whole side of the game and what the story is doing because it's not like the most prominent aspect of the game. There haven't been that many cutscenes. They don't intro the characters very well. Especially if you don't know the history, they don't give you a lot of that context. But if you do have some of that background and you pay attention to what they're doing, I think there are a lot of interesting things they're doing in the story side of the game as well that I'm really excited to see where it goes. In particular, I'm just really excited to meet Tokugawa in this game and see what they do with him as a character because obviously he's a very loaded historical figure that there's a lot of different ways you can portray him. So, yeah.
Nice.
It's an awesome fucking game. If people have not played it and are sleeping on this one, I highly recommend it. Obviously, it is something that if this is not your kind of game because of like the style and the combat, I totally get that. But if you've ever enjoyed one of these kinds of games, I think Nioh is a must play.
Nice. I am so curious to see how different our top 10 lists are going to be this year.
Right, yeah.
We're both going to have Persona 5.
Yes.
Beyond that, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what the commonalities are. It's going to be a really interesting one.
Yeah, but I can definitely assure you that this is going to be on it.
Nice. Well, next week, Sean,
is
D-Day. We get three games on Friday, October 27th. We get Assassin's Creed Origins.
Yeah.
Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus.
Yep.
It's from okay. Nepal. And we get Super Mario Odyssey. I will be playing Super Mario Odyssey.
I will be playing Wolfenstein 2. I will probably, if I've not finished Nioh, I'll take a break from Nioh because I will probably be able to play through Wolfenstein 2 in 2 days if it's like Wolfenstein 1. So.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not sure how much we'll have gotten through these games, although I have cleared my calendar for Mario Odyssey Day.
Sure.
On that Friday and Saturday, so I can just dive the fuck into that game and just get that sweet Mario into my veins. I am so excited.
I'm like really excited to just fucking mow down some Nazis. I think that will be a nice therapeutic thing in the year of our Lord 2017.
And I am also excited to see a fucking review for Assassin's Creed Origins.
Yes.
So I know whether or not I should pick that game up. Because if I do, I'd like to get it like kind of on launch day, even if I'm not going to play it, just for the discounts and stuff.
Sure, yeah.
But I would like to see if it's worth it or not. It probably will be. It looks like a good one.
Yeah.
But who knows?
I'm very curious about it.
There's still a lot of year left to go. But Mario, oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, there's a lot of year left to go and a lot of game to play. And there's not enough fucking time to play them.
But, you know, I've got my stash. I've got panache, as the Mario Odyssey song says. So I'm ready to do the Odyssey.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, one thing that's a very morbid thing, but if there's too many video games for you, hey, EA's taking care of that problem for us, isn't it?